Let's bring it to order. Thank you, everyone. Welcome. Can I know who's on the phone?
This is Joyce Neumeier on the phone.
Joyce. Okay. Welcome, Joyce. Anyone else? Nope. Okay. So welcome. Last meeting, we had a lot of questions that we wanted answered and kind of set the framework for some data. So today we have lots of presenters and data going to be given to us. One quick announcement to this group is that DCBS has had a permanent director appointed, Cameron Smith, who is currently the director of Veteran Affairs, will be starting at DCBS on Thursday, the 21st. So this is my last meeting with all of you, and he will be here next time. So, Oliver, you had a slide you wanted to kind of go over.
Great.
And then.
Thank you, Gene. So I'm really excited that we have Robert Murray here. He is the former executive director of the Maryland Health Cost Commission for, I think, almost two decades. And so I think if there's a foremost expert about the Maryland model that is in this country, we have him with us here in the room today. So really want to say thank you, Robert, for coming out here, and I want to thank the Hospital Association for making that possible this morning. So we'll hear for the first kind of 2 hours, really turn this over to Robert to talk through the Maryland model. The slides are on Ola's slides, and then we'll shift and kind of visit some other states in terms of the history of hospital rate setting in five other states, and then move to some of the data pieces that we put out last week. So before I hand this over to Robert, I just want to throw up a couple of questions. I think this is really important for you all as members of the task force to be thinking about these questions during today's presentation, because that will help us as staff to go away and work with OHA and DCBS, the larger project team, making sure that we're bringing the analyses, the different data sets, and kind of doing some deeper dives in various places. So those are the four questions. Obviously, if you're reading the fifth one, hopefully I hear a chuckle, just to make sure everyone's awake early on a Friday morning. We can take odds on whether or not that'll happen next year offline. But please think through these questions, and that will allow us to go back and do our additional homework in advance of the 19th. Last thing I'll leave you with is, we're also fortunate, Robert has agreed to do a follow-up, so if there are questions that are specific to Maryland, he's agreed to do some follow-up, whether that's in writing or possibly even coming on, at least via the phone at a future meeting. We'll work out the logistics or what that looks like, but we have them this morning, but we may also have some additional opportunity to have your expertise shared with the task force.
I'm happy to do so.
Okay, great. So I will turn this over to Robert and bring you the clicker.
Great. Thank you, Oliver. Thank you, everyone, for inviting me. I was honored that you actually have my title as National Health Policy Expert. So that's thank you for thinking me in that light. It's great being here too, because my sister lives in Silverton, so I got to stop by and see her for a couple hours last night, and she was saying next time you have to stay longer. So unfortunately, I'm heading back to the East Coast this evening, but happy to be here and to try to shed some light on the Maryland rate setting system. As Oliver said, I was there for a long period of time, from 1993 as deputy director, became executive director in 94, and left the commission in 2011. So I saw kind of a period of change, and that's what I'd like to do, is kind of step through before I was there, while I was there, what we experienced, and then after I was at the commission, what's happened since. So you'll hear me talk about an old model, which is really the model that was put in place originally that I inherited, and then a new model, which is the model that started effectively in 2014. And by old and new, is they really changed what I refer to as the structure or the basis of payment. And I'll go through some of that at the beginning as well. It's really kind of a retrospective, but I do know a lot about the new model because as a consultant, I represent Care First Blue Cross of Maryland before the commission on a monthly basis, and am very engaged with staff, some of my old staff, in terms of policy issues and determinations that occur. So hopefully I can give you a perspective on both. So what I'd like to do is just kind of go through the background, start talking about that initial period. Talk about the commission itself, how it's structured, organized, the funding of it, the governance, the commission, which is a board of seven, and I'll talk about that. Talk about the staff and the functions of staff, their expertise. Then break up the discussion of the commission experience into maybe two or three different periods. The period just before I got there, and then the period I was there up through 2011. I have some data on Maryland, a comparison of Maryland overall statistics and health expenditures to Oregon health expenditures. There's a very handy source that just became available from the federal government, the National Health Spending Accounts. If you Google that, or I can give you the link, there's a nice database by payer, a Medicare, Medicaid, private sector, that shows their estimates by state for health expenditures, even broken down into service categories. So that may be useful for you, at least as a general consistent source to compare Oregon to Maryland in a detailed basis. I'll talk a lot about the Medicare waiver, which is really what makes Maryland unique, any sort of rate setting unique, if they're able to negotiate a waiver with Medicare, because it's what makes the system all payer. It brings Medicare and Medicaid in to pay on a consistent basis with the private sector. We'll try to transition into the new model. Talk a little bit about the characteristics and requirements of that. I'll talk about the performance of that model, at least from my perspective, over the first 4 years. They started in 14, and now they're gone through 3 years through calendar 17. Talk about it from a quality perspective and also a cost perspective, and then kind of the implications of rate setting overall in Maryland for the various parties, or what people refer to as stakeholders. That term is new to me. I usually just refer to them as interested parties. And then, some conclusions and pros and cons. And I would recommend that you stop me as we go through this. We've got 2 hours or more, so please stop if I'm going too fast or if there's something that pops out or a point you want to make. So please, by all means, do that. Before I get into the discussion of the Maryland system, I thought it might be worthwhile to provide what I've characterized as system payment basics. This is from one of the documents that Oliver sent out, and I apologize, it's a very long document, but we tried to talk about the background of rate setting, the history of rate setting, focus on Maryland and also West Virginia. And at the very beginning of the discussion, I tried to lay out the different structures of payment that have been used in any type of payment system, whether it be here in the United States with Medicare or the Medicaid programs or private insurers or internationally, Canada, Europe. When policymakers look at how they're going to structure a system, they kind of look at this configuration. And it refers to what I call the basis of payment. And largely, these are all prospective payment systems, as opposed to a retrospective payment structure. A retrospective payment structure would be a cost-based reimbursement system, where you look retrospectively what the provider's costs were, and then their payments the next year are a function of what their reported costs were the previous year. So think about all of our discussion and everything that we did at the Commission and most all payment systems as being prospective in nature. And these are different, what I've referred to as bases of payment, or they're really structures of payment, and they are differentiated by the level of bundling of services in the type of unit that is being paid for. And the key element or component that you should think about in moving from left to right is that as you bundle more services into the unit of payment, you're transferring more risk from the payer to the provider, financial risk for the cost and the services that are being provided within that bundle. And that transfer of financial risk, if you go all the way out to the end of the spectrum, it's capitated risk, and that's insurance risk. You transfer more incentive, financial incentive, from the payer to the provider to manage costs. And that means both units of service utilization as well as unit costs, the actual cost of operating the services. And you see, I stuck out to the left. That's not on my chart in the document. But cost-based reimbursement, there's virtually no risk transferred because whatever the provider spends, they know next year they're going to be reimbursed for basically what their costs are. And so there's virtually no transfer of risk and virtually no cost containment incentive embodied in that payment structure to the left. But then as you move right, you start out with bundling services into a unit of measure. And a unit of measure may be a day in the hospital or a minute of operating time in the operating room or a relative value unit for certain ancillary services. And their hospitals are at risk for the costs for each of those units. Then you move to the right, and you have a per diem type of payment system. So anything that's provided to a patient at a hospital during the course of a stay, per day, they're at risk for. And then you move further to the right, and you have a DRG-based payment system, or it's per case, much like many Medicaid programs provide now, and certainly Medicare pioneered the use of DRGs nationally. Then further on, there are predefined bundles of payments, episode-based payment. In Maryland, we bundled in the readmission costs with the actual cost of the DRG. So we're providing the bundling of 30-day readmissions with the DRG payment. So it's, again, an expansion of services, hospitals more at risk for a broader array of services. And then finally, we went to one that should be in between, which is hospital global budgets, where we set a fixed budget for the hospital that didn't vary regardless of what volume utilization they experienced during the year. So you kind of think of that structure, and the commission kind of worked its way through that structure over time, and I'll talk about that in my presentation. This chart's a little harder to see, but it has the same basic array of increasing the bundles of services as you go from left to right, and it shows that risk transfer as you're moving from cost-based reimbursement to itemized unit rates to per diems to per case episodes, global budgets out to capitation. The payment structure is transferring financial risk from the payer, whether it be a governmental payer or a private payer, to the hospital to manage that care. Hmm. Now, that's good because it provides stronger incentives for the hospital to manage the care. It can be bad because the more financial risk you place on the hospital, the more they have to manage it, and they have to be able to manage it. If they're very small and you have a lot of fluctuation in financial risk like you would under a global budget, it can be very financially deleterious to a hospital if they are under like a global budget and all of a sudden they have a spike in influenza cases or some other big catastrophe from a health standpoint. They won't have enough money to be able to handle that. So the key is when you transfer financial risk, the provider has to have the capability to manage that risk. That's kind of a fundamental thought.
Robert?
Yes.
If I can go back just that
sure.
slide. I'm just curious about the inflection point there. Is it significant at that particular payment rate, or is it?
I think it's just that's just arbitrary. This is a graph that I pulled off of another publication. Hopefully, I cited it. I think in my publication, the inflection point is probably about there. But the way the graph is set up with my labels, it's a little bit arbitrary. And it just meant conceptually to show this risk transfer. I can tell you under DRGs, hospitals assume a lot of risk because the DRG is an average payment, as you know, for a given diagnosis like pneumonia or cardiac surgery. And there's a distribution of cases under that around that average. And that distribution, if you're a large hospital, is fairly narrow. And so the cases that are below the average, you're winning on. The cases that are above the average, you're losing on. But in general, when you have large numbers of cases, it works out. It evens out. But for a small hospital, being under DRG payment, if you're getting cases skewing one way or the other along all the diagnosis, you can assume a lot of financial risk. So that in many cases, depending upon what size provider you are, could be an inflection point in terms of the risk that you're assuming. And we can come back to that slide as well. So getting into the Maryland experience, and back to the 1960s, this was significant in terms of the structure or basis of payment, because at that point in time, all the major payers paid on the basis of retrospective payment, cost-based reimbursement. Medicare, Medicaid, even Blue Cross paid costs based on what your reported costs were. And that system, as I mentioned, has no constraint, doesn't transfer risk. And as a result, it was highly inflationary. There's really major cost growth during that period, and as Oliver goes through the history of rate setting, we'll see it wasn't just Maryland that was experiencing this, it was all the states, and particularly in the Northeast, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts. The Medicaid program in Maryland was generating big deficits during this period of time. So state government was supportive of trying to set up a system that would try to control costs. The other implication that was very interesting was that because hospitals are paid on the basis of defined cost by these major payers, and the payers didn't define cost as providing the cost to uninsured patients, the hospitals had no mechanism to finance care to the uninsured. And so they had an interest, the hospital association had an interest in some type of payment structure that would provide money to pay for the cost of care provided to the uninsured. And that was one of the major reasons why the Maryland Hospital Association supported this and indeed did the original drafts of our statute in their offices back in the late 60s, early 70s. And there were a number of hospitals, particularly in Baltimore City, that are on the verge of financial bankruptcy because of that factor. So these and other factors kind of led to the formation of a coalition. It was largely the Maryland Hospital Association with labor and business representation. And the interesting thing about the Hospital Association was it was run at that time primarily by hospital trustees who were business and labor leaders. So they had the dialogue already kind of taking place and thinking about it from a larger public policy process. And the hospitals then were convinced, we're willing to do the trade-off of if we can get financing for uncompensated care and stability in our financing structure year to year, we'll trade off price, you know, that for price controls. That was kind of the equation that they went through in their own minds. And this is an anecdotal fact, but Andy Davidson, the president of the Oregon Hospital Association, you know, his father, Dick Davidson, was the president of the Maryland Hospital Association at the time. So Andy was probably in preschool when his dad was drafting. I don't know how old Andy is, but so he, you know, that's not to say he's familiar with it, and he understands that background and in terms of the coalition. It was a very unique set of circumstances. Talk a little bit again, you know, kind of dovetailing into the formation of the HSCRC. The key goals that were implicit in our statute were a result of these policy issues that I mentioned that needed to be addressed. Control the rapid growth and costs. And it's really bend the curve, not reduce costs, but rather bend the curve so that we're growing more slowly. And that then provides more savings to the public, meaning a lower increase in premiums, a lower taxes to fund Medicare and Medicaid, things of that nature. Improve access to care, and that's that financing uncompensated care that I mentioned. Have a system in the rates structure that will pay for reasonable amounts of uncompensated care that a hospital might experience during the year. And you'll hear me say that word reasonable. It's kind of a subjective term, but that is something that we try to reference back to when we set some of these payment structures. Make the system more equitable. And now, as you well know, the payment system for hospitals is not at all equitable. You've got Medicare and Medicaid that pay pretty low, and then the private sector is forced in many cases because hospitals raise their charges to pay much more. So you'll get a particular procedure like open heart surgery, and the private sector might be paying $35,000, $40,000 per case, whereas Medicare and Medicaid may be paying $17,000 or $15,000 when the cost is like $17,000. So that's not an equitable payment system. In Maryland, because of the waiver, basically all the payers would pay about the same amount. And that's what the waiver did for us. It allowed us to create this more equitable system. There's also a desire to collect a lot of data and information, then do reports and provide more transparency on the system. And certainly all of the payment data, the rates that we set and then the actual payments to the hospitals were all publicly available and have been since 1977. And then the last is an emphasis on providing financial stability and predictability. It's been referred to as a utility model of rate regulation, just the idea that hospitals are sort of natural monopolies and there's a public interest to be able to maybe moderate their price growth over time and the prices that they set. The original executive director studied public utility economics at Dartmouth, Cornell in the 50s and 60s, and then was teaching at Georgia. And when the system started, he applied for the job, and he was the right man. He was just unbelievable. His name was Hal Cohen, but he was really responsible for setting all of this up. The authority for the commission is just facility charges. We don't set rates for physicians. Originally, there was a provision in our statute to set the rates for hospital-based physicians, the ologists, the radiologists, the pathologists, anesthesiologists. But then we were sued in court, and we lost that case, so that authority was removed. But there is a public policy or economic rationale to set the rates of these hospital-based physicians because they are natural monopolies as well. And, you know, if you're a patient, you go in, you're out of network, and you have an operation, all of a sudden, oh, your anesthesiologist wasn't in network. And I know you have a balanced bill provision here, but it really puts the consumer at risk in that type of structure. We're politically and legally pretty independent. It varies over time, and I'll get back to that. There is this issue of regulatory capture that does happen. And when I say regulatory capture, the industry either directly or indirectly tries to capture the regulator. And in that issue of capture, the dynamic of capture has occurred, I think, in all rate-setting states. The language in our statute, and I would encourage you to read it. In fact, Washington State adopted our statute almost verbatim. So it's important to have a good statute, but they weren't able to pull it off. But our law is very broad. It gave us a lot of flexibility in terms of how we structured things. The key steps, 71 statute was passed, 72 Hal Cohen came to the commission. We created a uniform accounting and reporting system, and then we began a period of data collection and started setting the methodologies themselves. And finally we started in 74 setting rates. We completed setting the rates for all 50 hospitals in 1977. So it was a 5 or 6 year period. And I think you could probably speed that up a bit now, but it is a fairly major undertaking. And then, as I said, we were challenged during this period of time, largely from the hospital industry. Individual hospitals brought court cases. We were challenged 5 times. I think we won 4 of those cases, the one being the hospital-based physician case that we lost. Quick overview of Maryland characteristics, currently a little bigger than Oregon, very high per capita income. There are large inner-city populations in Baltimore City and then also in the district, because Maryland, as you know, borders the district. There are 52 acute care hospitals. Really, we regulate 48 directly on an all-payer basis. About 6 rural, suburban, what I would consider to be rural, semi-small, medium-sized hospitals, 20 medium to large suburban, and then 15 medium to large urban hospitals, two academic teaching hospitals you're aware of, University of Maryland, Johns Hopkins. And there are five health systems that control 30 of the hospitals. University of Maryland's the biggest. Hopkins is the second. There's also one that is in the district that owns four hospitals in Maryland called MedStar. There's the Adventist healthcare system, and then also another system in Baltimore is called LifeBridge. Then the total revenue is about $16 billion, and the split back then was about 80-20 when we started. Now it's about 60-40 inpatient, outpatient. Yes?
Just a quick question. Do any of those health systems provide a health insurance product?
Yes. Over time, they've gravitated into two lines of business that are at risk. There are 9 Medicaid MCOs in the state, and I believe 5 of them are provider-sponsored. So Hopkins sponsors a Medicaid MCO, so they take risk for that. And a couple of the other health systems have MCOs as well. And then more recently, Hopkins, MedStar, and University have gotten into the Medicare Advantage market.
So, okay, in Oregon, a couple of our large health systems offer insurance products to employers on the exchange.
Huh.
A few of them now, I feel like in the last year, others are starting to partner with other health insurance entities, looking, mm-hmm. I should be careful how I characterize this, but they look more and more like Kaiser Permanente in some ways, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Than maybe they used to.
Mm-hmm. There were discussions. I know, in particular, MedStar hired a consultant to help them look at how they could vertically integrate into taking risk for insurance. And I'm not the expert there when it comes to the advisability of providers getting into the insurance game or the public policy implications. I can tell you that in Maryland, most have not been very successful at it. Hopkins had a health plan a number of years ago, went bankrupt, and all the MA plans are losing money now. And some of that is startup. Medicare Advantage plans in Maryland that are provider-owned. The provider-run MCOs have just been marginally successful. So for whatever set of reasons, providers getting into the insurance game has not been successful. And in Maryland, we do have Kaiser, but they don't own their own hospitals. They partner with individual hospitals.
They do both.
Yes.
They have two hospitals.
Yep. Right.
But outside the metro service area, they contract.
Yeah. Right. So I'm not the right person. Jack Keane, if you speak to him, it would probably have some better perspectives on that.
May I ask a follow-up question there?
Yes.
There is one predominant insurance company, though.
Yeah, I'll talk about that.
You will? Okay.
Yeah,
Matt,
okay. But it's a good segue. The dominant insurer is my client, CareFirst Blue Cross of Maryland. Did 4 to 5 million in the DMV district, Maryland, Northern Virginia area. They have about 60% market share, so they are dominant.
Wow.
So in Oregon, you would know this, Gene. How many insurance there's 8?
12.
So how many in Maryland, just out of curiosity?
Well, so then in addition, you've got United, Aetna, Kaiser.
Okay.
And they account for the balance of the 40%.
Sorry.
And I don't know how it's broken up. I could find that out. Because the Department of Insurance does regulate rates, and they have all that information.
Okay.
The other interesting thing is 70% of CareFirst business is self-funded. So the employers directly pay the bill and the bill that for hospitals based on the rates the commission set. Although since the early days, employers have not been that active in did policy discussions around rate. I tried to get the employers and labor a lot more involved, and they just were kind of diverse and fragmented, not talking with a single voice. Just a couple of the
question over.
Yes.
Uh huh.
So do you have a sense? I'm trying to do the math in my head. What the total percent of lives in Maryland are in a self-funded plan or self-insured plan? Is it, we're about a quarter, roughly. Is it 70% of?
Well, so it's probably, but so that's the entire area. I don't know exactly what CareFirst. So they probably have 3 million lives in, I want to say, because they're about a million Medicare, a million Medicaid, and they may have close to 3 million lives in Maryland. So 70% of that.
Okay.
That would just very rough and ready. I could get that information for you if you want.
And Robert, we're working with the Maryland Insurance Administration to actually get more accurate data on what their marketplace looks like.
Yeah, sure. This is rough. This is kind of just off the top of my head, but Blue Cross is the dominant insurer there.
But the rates apply, or it's optional for the self-funded plans to use the same rates.
Well, no, they do apply for the self-funded plan. So CareFirst is the ASO, and they service the claims, and CareFirst has to pay, by law, has to pay the rates of the HSCRC, my old agency. There are ACOs that have started in Maryland. 12 are hospital-based, mixed performance. None of them are at risk. They're all, you know, upside-only risk. One is now at risk. Nine physician-affiliated MSSP ACOs. They're doing a little bit better, but, you know, this is all just kind of fledgling. CareFirst also operates very robust and, I think, successful, and it's been documented as being successful in the literature, what they refer to as patient-centric medical home. And it is not your standard medical home. It provides incentives like the ACOs, shared savings that go back to the practices. They're organized a little differently, groups of practices. But the idea is, if on a budgetary basis the practices can save money, the PCPs can earn very, very large rewards. And then CareFirst has also provided a care management infrastructure and information system infrastructure to support the care activity of the PCPs. The reason why I like that program, A, they're my client, but B, I think the primary care focus is really one of the keys to bending the cost curve over time. They extended the PCMH also to Medicare. So the idea is, if you have both commercial and Medicare, and that's a big proportion of each PCP's medical panel, and you can sort of supercharge the incentives as a result of that.
I have a question. Sorry, this is going back a second. I just want to make sure I understand this.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just explain the basis for how the commission can set rates for ERISA plans, the self-funded plans, since generally those aren't state-regulated? Is it that you're setting the rates for the hospital and not for the plan, or how does it work?
It was that particular point was a source of legal challenge in New Jersey, and it led to the demise of the New Jersey rate setting system, because the circuit court ruled in favor of the ERISA plans, and the New Jersey system went up in smoke. That subsequently was a challenge in New York, and then it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld the authority of state-based regulatory agencies to set rates that apply to ERISA plans, because it wasn't violative of ERISA. So that is a Supreme Court ruling, and that's why we're still in business. Yeah. As I mentioned, I mentioned the Medicare Advantage, only because I know Medicare Advantage is very, very big here, and it's a great plan, and I think there's like 40-45% penetration in Medicare beneficiaries here. In Maryland, it's less than 7. Maybe it's a little higher now. But it relates to how the premiums are set. Maryland, you'll see, is very high in Medicare costs per capita, and that affects the premium that the Medicare Advantage plans get. But we have very low penetration. I just wanted to point that out. Just a few statistics in terms of Medicaid. I'll try to speed this up. General results, and this is kind of during my tenure, so I apologize. This is an old slide. I think it's still representative. We have very low growth in cost per case, because that's what we regulated. We set DRGs, so we were regulating the payment per case over time, and so we did a pretty good job of that. We also did a good job of ensuring access, because we built significant amounts of money, reasonable funding for each hospital to finance uncompensated care, both charity care and bad debt. So when I say uncompensated care, I'm referring to both. The system is also very equitable because it prohibits cost shifting. The dynamic of hospitals raising their charges arbitrarily so that the private payers, whatever contracting basis they're under, pay more to cross-subsidize, quote, lower payments from Medicare and Medicaid. We do not allow that. So as a result, the markup from cost to charges or cost to payment has been traditionally the very lowest in the United States and Maryland. It's because of the rate setting. It's provided, I think, very, very robust financial stability for the hospitals. And also, you know, we collect a lot of data. I don't know why this is one of my slides that didn't work out. But that shows the rate of growth of hospital. Maryland is the blue line, or the yellow, the red, whatever, purple line, and then the U.S. is, it's indexed. We were at a much higher level and then kind of sloped down, but I indexed it from 76, and so you can see on an index basis the rate of growth. And again, this is cost per case. Let me skip through this because I didn't mean this to be animated.
I don't want to monopolize the conversation, but
yeah, sure.
Quick question. On the point about transparency of the rate setting process and so forth, it seems like one potential advantage of having a system like this is that it would make it a lot easier for a patient to find out the cost of a procedure for them.
Because generally,
it wouldn't vary by their coverage. So is there more transparency at the point of?
Well, it would vary. Well, they'd still have to work their way through their benefit package.
Oh, sure.
and what their responsibilities, and then they would have to get a sense of, see, one thing we haven't done a good job, which I think Oregon's done a better job, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, maybe Vermont, of having this information readily available where a consumer could go online and take a look at it. But there's still a lot of machinations that have to go through, you know, going in for a hip procedure or cardiac surgery. You don't know exactly what your severity of illness is going to be, and the payment's going to be the function of that. So there's still a lot of machinations you have to go through. You could do a comparison of hospitals on the basis of averages for cardiac surgery and outcomes, and that information is available. It's not as consumer-friendly as it could be. But so theoretically, it could help. But also shopping, consumers doing shopping is sometimes very, I think, problematic. It's difficult, as you know, because of the complexity. These are data from that national spending account. Yes.
I didn't see on the previous slide or on the characteristics, but how many, do you have a sense of how many kind of critical access or smaller hospitals you have, and is the methodology the same?
Yeah, we have no actual critical access hospitals in Maryland. We have maybe two that could apply and become critical access. And then the other rurals are much bigger. They're in the, you know, $100 million range. They could have opted out of the system and been paid on the basis of cost, but they didn't. They never did because, you know, the rate setting also provides sort of stability for the other payers. These are the data from the national spending accounts. I put this together, which show in billions, total expenditures, $51 billion in 2014 in Maryland, $32 billion in Oregon. And then it showed the breakout by payer class. And again, I disassembled it, and you can kind of duplicate it and look how that's varied by year. And as I mentioned, there are data on there by service also. You can see what proportion is hospital versus others. This chart, I think, is even more useful because it highlights the difference between Maryland and Oregon that does relate directly to the presence of the waiver. You can see we're, you know, more or less comparable in terms of private sector cost per capita or payment per revenue per capita. But we stand out dramatically on Medicare and also Medicaid, and that's largely because of the Medicare waiver for hospitals. And I'll go into this, but when we negotiated the waiver in 1977, we locked in much higher payments for Medicare and Medicaid that have just been part of the system ever since. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to keep the waiver just because we've been able to grow more slowly from a much higher base. But that is the big advantage to Maryland of the Medicare waiver.
Interesting.
And why the hospitals support it, the payers support it, and because if it were to be ever pulled, we would lose a tremendous amount of funding from both Medicare and Medicaid. But that's, it shows that, you know, the dynamic. In fact, we quantified, a colleague, as of 2014, Maryland was getting $2.3 billion more in governmental payments than they would in the absence of the waiver at that period of time. That's on a $16 billion base. So it if we were to lose the waiver, it would be catastrophic. This shows, getting into more of kind of the operations of the commission, we report directly to the governor. That was part of our statute. We don't report to the Department of Health. Other rate-setting systems have been embodied in the Department of Health, and this was done intentionally to try to make us a little more politically independent. And to be honest with you, the governor, from year to year, has stayed out of our business. And partly we're advantaged because the rate-setting system's so complicated, nobody wants to. You get in a room and you start to explain it to people, and it's like, enough. And that's really ideally or honestly part of the dynamic. But there's also this idea of let them do what they're doing, and, you know, as long as they're not really alienating a lot of people, we can let them go. The commission itself is run by a board of 7 volunteer commissioners. Other rate-setting states actually hired full-time professional commissioners. West Virginia has 3 full-time hired commissioners. There's a kind of difference of opinion about what's better, having volunteers or having people you hire. In general, the thought was, with the state salary structure, you couldn't hire the caliber of people with the experience that you need to help run the commission and set the policy direction. So the idea, it's a prestigious position. The governor went out and would pick people that had experience with hospital care and insurance and public policy and bring them in, and they serve on a voluntary basis. They get paid $100 per diem to show up at a meeting once a month. It's a pretty significant time commitment.
But I meet monthly.
Wow.
But there's no salary.
How much time do the commissioners actually have to spend?
Well, each public meeting is about 5 hours plus. Sometimes there are executive sessions in the morning. So once a month, 5 to 8 hours plus any preparation time. And the materials are substantial. And then there are periodic conference calls and sometimes meetings that they're involved in. They're not really involved in the day-to-day. So I would say it's a day or two a month that they're devoting to this.
Formal meeting.
Yeah, right. And the rest of the time, they're probably having nightmares about it. But
so, under that system, is it like staff people bring a thing to them?
Yeah,
and
right.
It's been going for a while, so I'm assuming it's a little bit more baked than it would be with a brand new system where maybe there'd be a lot of questions.
That's a very good observation. That's pretty much. That's the way it goes. The staff will pretty much originate every, and you'll see when I was there, there were a number of things that we tried to bring forward in transitioning to a new system. So we originated those ideas and brought them to the commission, and then they had to react to it. I can tell you, I felt a little awkward. I had mixed feelings about this. The rate-setting system is so technical that it gives staff a lot of autonomy. Tremendous amount of autonomy and actual power too, because
right, I would figure, not to interrupt, but
yeah, no,
I mean, unless you really know a lot about this particular topic,
yes,
you're gonna say, well, we have full-time people that we have hired
right
to do this, they went to school, you know, they like, and I'm gonna, you know, use negative phrasing, sort of rubber stamp
been used before, yes,
you know, what they sort of bring to us,
right,
provided some big hospital system who I have some connection to or maybe not, isn't waving some sort of flag saying, oh, my God.
Yeah. There are checks and balances, but to a large extent, because of the complexity and because of the trust between the commission and the staff, the commissioners and the lack of time that they have to really go into detail and understand it, they try to look at the big picture, but it does confer a lot of power to staff. And as I said, I felt a little uncomfortable with that but then after time, you're like, well, I think I know what I'm doing, or we know what we're doing, and there are people we rely on. I can tell you, I relied a lot on Hal Cohen, who was outside of the commission at that time, but had such a great policy perspective. I would really rely a lot on his perspective. So,
what was the average tenure of your commission members?
They serve 4-year staggered terms, and they can serve 2 terms, consecutive terms. But some are retreads. They come back, some have been on, 8 years, and they're off for 1 or 2, and then they come back for several years. So some have served 12. And Jack Keane, who you hope you could talk to, he ran the Massachusetts rate setting system. He then, when they kicked him out of Massachusetts, he came down to Maryland and worked with Hal Cohen for several years, and is now a commissioner. Has been a commissioner for 7 years. So full-time staff, 28. And under the old model, 40 plus or minus now under the new model. And you think about the new model is trying to expand into population-based health and controlling total cost of care. You'll hear me talk a lot about that. That's basically soup to nuts expenditures in the healthcare system. Long-term care, pharmaceuticals, physicians, freestanding, as well as hospitals. It's quite a big, thing to bite off.
So does that mean they're going to, so they've been focused just on hospital costs?
Primarily.
And they're going to now broaden to look at the
But during the first 4 years of the new model, there were some tests or limitations relating to total cost of care growth. But the focus of the first 4-5 years of the new model were hospital per capita, Medicare per capita growth. Now the next phase of this new model is much more focused on total cost of care. And that's a big challenge. My staff, and this is largely still the same configuration, economists, researchers, statisticians, accountants, financial people. We did hire consultants. They're hiring a lot more in the way of consulting assistants now. The consultants are really kind of more people who had worked at the commission that had that strong background, like Hal Cohen, that could help us. We had 2 divisions, basically, in the old model, just rate setting and methodology and research. And now the focus is, rate setting, methodology, but also population health. And there's a division, I think, called consumer engagement. This is hard to see, but hopefully you have hard copy. But this was my staff, 11, I think 10 in rate setting, 11 in research and methodology. Research and methodology is primarily data collection, data function-related functions analysis. I had a health economist who was the head of that division. That would be kind of the origin of some methodology development, whether it be new payment structures or their quality-based reimbursement that we implemented. And then the rate-setting folks were, so this is research, and the rate-setting folks were manufacturing. They got the rates put on rate orders. They looked at the compliance of setting rates and got them out the door. So that's kind of an overview of the structure, at least when I was there. I just wanted to emphasize really extensive data collection that we're required to do to set rates. Initially, as I said, setting up a uniform accounting system that hospitals had to report on, meaning how they allocated their cost to revenue departments, cost departments, how they accounted for their volumes of service by revenue department, and also other financial information. So it's akin to the Medicare cost report, but even more detailed than the Medicare cost report. And hospitals in Maryland had to fill out both, but they focused on ours because it really impacted their rates. We also, the major second database is what I refer to as a case mix database, and that's where the hospitals have to use their information systems, and this is common knowledge now, but we were sort of blazing the path because we were the first system to set up DRGs, where they have to integrate the medical record information with the financial cost information for each payment. So they would look at the medical record for Joe Blow and see that he had, you know, these procedures and these diagnoses, and then match up that coded medical record information with his financial information and then send that to us. And then we would make use of it using the coded diagnosis information to assign a DRG to that patient. And then we'd use the cost information to set the average payment by DRG. That was kind of the basis of the DRG payment. We had to couple that up and then get the information sent to us. And then the other thing is then we had to automate it. And this is back before PCs, and we, you know, so we're getting computer tapes. And we had to automate it enough so that we're getting these data on a quarterly basis. And we got the data on a quarterly basis 30 to 60 days after the end of the quarter so we could make use of it in rate setting and then set the prospective rates, you know, each year based on that data. But a really significant data requirement.
Hey, Robert.
Yes.
I have a question about, I'm interested in the DRG methodology.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you said, it was added after you got started.
Right.
And then CMS DRG methodology is primarily for Medicare. Is that fair?
Yes.
So did you, have to do something to make it applicable to commercial populations or?
Yeah, that's a really good question. If we could defer that question just a bit, because I'm going to get into the, kind of that transition from unit rates to DRGs. Other data, I don't need to go through this, but volume revenue data, we needed to get monthly charges and volumes so we could take the charges, divide them by the units of service to see if they're charging our rate on average. So there's a big compliance function that's required there.
Hmm.
Other data, wage and salary, because we'd make adjustments for, in the DRG payment, we'd make adjustments for wage, area wage differences. We also would get information on uncompensated care and graduate medical education. And then financial statements on a monthly basis. And then now the new model is even requires a new set of data, a lot of quality-related data. We look at in-state resident charges versus out-of-state because of the waiver test is only for residents. And then we get Medicare data that will compare us to how we're doing nationally. So just go a little bit of detail into the unit rate setting system. Well, as I said, we had this uniform cost reporting system that was set up. The hospitals were required to report all of their cost data allocated to departmental or cost centers. They would also report the volumes of services. So an example would be the daily care areas, MedSurg, CCU, ICU. They would allocate direct costs and indirect costs to each one of those departments and then accumulate a volume measure, days, so that we could see what their average cost was per day. And we did that for all of the revenue centers, operating room, clinic, ED, radiology. We'd set a relative value unit, was a defined unit measure for the ancillary areas. And that was the basis of the unit rate setting system. And this is what the unit rate setting system looked like. Remember, it was kind of the far left end of that chart in terms of the bundling of services under the unit of payment. Not a lot of services bundled when you're charging on this disaggregated way. You know, a hospital happened to keep a patient an extra 2-3 days, they'd get paid more. And if they added more services or more drugs, they'd get paid more. So not a lot of risk transfer. They're at risk for the cost within each of these departments, but not in aggregate. And we learned pretty quickly that it didn't provide strong cost containment incentive because when we put the system in, it was prospective in that although we relied on historical costs to get it started, we then updated these rates by some uniform inflation percentage. So we were controlling the rate of growth of these prices, but in response, hospitals did more units, did more days, tests. And so the system was not very effective. That's the kind of the basis of the economics of you know, hospital care to a certain extent. So, as I said, the unit rates were based on actual costs. We moved it to a prospective system where we were inflating the rate per unit over time, but in response, hospitals did more units, and so it proved not to be a very effective system. So just a minute on the economics of volume growth and what we learned kind of the hard way two times. We found, and these are very crude measures, and it varies based on the size of the hospital and the service mix, but we found, looking at our data, that in a crude way, hospital costs are about 50% fixed. You know, capital, utilities, to a certain extent, you know, wages, salaries of certain personnel, and 50% variable with volume. And if you have that type of economic equation and you're being paid 100 cents on the dollar for every new case you get, and your variable costs for every new case are only 50 cents on the dollar, it makes economic sense for you to do more cases. And that was the dynamic in that unit rate structure that we talked about. It's also the dynamic when we moved to DRGs, that they had the same incentive to do more cases if their fixed costs were 50%, their variable costs were 50%, but they got 100 cents on the dollar for each new case. And that the hospitals, that's one thing we've learned, they respond to incentives. And so we had to take that into consideration. But keep that in mind. The flip side of that is true as well, which creates kind of a conundrum for policymakers, which is if you invest heavily in primary care and primary care starts to now reduce the number of cases, unnecessary cases, take them out of the system, hospitals under a fee-for-service system are going to lose money because they've got high fixed costs that they have to cover. So that's a conundrum. Any payment system needs to take that into consideration. You've got to provide the hospital money to cover their fixed costs going up or going down. Otherwise, they'll, you know, it just undermines the incentive of a prospective system. So we, to counteract this dynamic of unit rates, we moved to a DRG system in 1976. We're the first jurisdiction in the world to use DRGs. And as I showed you, as you move from unit rates to DRGs, you transfer more financial risk to the hospital. Outpatient services were still under the unit rate system, although we did move to a per visit system later. And we found, we were worried that hospitals would engage in those same sorts of behaviors of, you know, trying to increase volumes. So in addition to going to the DRG system, we put in place what we refer to as the volume adjustment system, or the VAS. And that was structured, so we had control of all their revenues and all their rates, and we could adjust their rates up or down for any reason that we wanted. And what we did is we structured the volume adjustment system to only provide revenue at the end of the day associated with their marginal costs or their variable costs, and not provide that extra 50 cents on the dollar for new cases. And that effectively neutralized their incentive to increase volumes. So you had a system that controlled per case growth, but also controlled volume over time. And it was a very effective system, such that if you look at that fifth bullet down, we were 25% above the United States in average cost per case in 76. But by 92, we were 12% below. We really bent that curve down dramatically. And then the other interesting thing is that volumes only grew at about population growth during this period of time. So it's a very effective system. So moving along, we also, at that period of time, at the very beginning of rate setting, Hal Cohen had always thought about the system needs to be all payer. So right when the system went into place, he started negotiating with Medicare. It was the Healthcare Financing Administration at the time. And they agreed that they would give us a demonstration waiver only after we had set rates for all the hospitals. We set rates, as I said, by 1977, so we negotiated the Medicare waiver starting July 1st of 1977. I don't know the precise structure of the test, but it was a rate of growth test where I believe we were similar to the test that was ultimately put into federal statute. We had to grow more slowly on a payment per case basis than the federal government over perpetuity. As long as we grew more slowly, we kept the waiver. So the waiver means that Medicare and Medicaid waive their rights to impose their own system of payment. So we're exempt from PPS, both inpatient and outpatient, IPPS and OPPS. At that point, Medicare was still paying on the basis of cost. They hadn't moved to their DRG system yet. We're the first state to have a waiver. We had to pass this test. The other states that negotiated waivers were New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey. Washington State got a waiver. And then there was also an interesting regional demonstration in Rochester, New York, and the Finger Lakes that got a waiver for an implementation of global budgets for hospitals, which was very innovative at the time. Characteristics, again, it eliminates cost shifting. Medicare is part of the system. Hospitals can't raise their charges arbitrarily to the private sector. All payers are contributing equitably to the hospital costs, including the amounts that we put in for uncompensated care or graduate medical education. It also just gave us a lot of autonomy. We could look at addressing local issues because it was kind of one-stop shopping for financial issues for the hospitals. An example of a local issue, we had several hospitals periodically run into significant financial difficulty. And so we provided bridge financing. We increased their rates for a period of time with the idea that they'd get through this rough patch, and then ultimately we would lower their rates so effectively they would pay it back. So it was like a short-term loan to the hospital. So the idea is to provide stability where we felt there was, it was a justifiable circumstance. Another example was a hospital system came to us. They had six or five hospitals. One of them was chronically losing money. It was a very high-cost hospital. And so we said, all right, we'll provide money in your rates for closing costs. We'll also provide money in your rates to defease your bonds. Because in the absence of that, they just would have kept this hospital running so that they didn't bilk the bondholders. And then as a result of all of this, they closed the hospital. They were very high costs, so the patients that were redistributed went to lower cost hospitals so that we could see that there was overall system savings. So you get those types of things, and you have people like Hal Cohen or Jack Keane that are very thoughtful, and you can do some very positive things. So that's an example of
Does Maryland have a certificate in need process?
So it's a separate agency, and I should have said that they're one of those agencies that report to the governor as our sister commission. They do CON for major capital projects and specialized services like open heart surgery. I'm not a big fan of CON, to be honest with you.
Do they ever say no, you can't build? Like,
no.
I feel like our certificate of need process is really pretty weak.
Yeah, they rarely say no. I mean, they do say no, but I don't know. I mean, if you have a rate system, it's controlling costs and it's a tight system, you really don't need CON in my mind. And the CON process gets highly politicized. Not that we haven't been, politicized, but I'm just not a fan of CON. So we've talked about this now. After the demonstration waiver went in, the Hospital Association and others said, hey, let's see if we can get this into federal statute. Because we had a senator named was Barbara Mikulski.
Yeah.
And so it was the waiver itself. Maryland is not mentioned in the statute, but we're the only system to continuously operate a system like this over a period of time. That was put in, I think, in 85, 1814B of the Social Security Act. So it would take an act of Congress to get rid of the waiver, whereas under a demonstration waiver, Medicare would say, we don't like it anymore.
Hmm.
And so from the hospital's perspective and everyone, it was much more secure to have it in federal statute. Now, there's still a waiver test. So if we failed the test, then that would have been problematic. I think we've covered most of this. But the key is that we started out 30% higher in Medicare payment per case than the nation. And because we locked that in through this cumulative rate of growth test, we got to keep that higher payment even to this day. And I'll illustrate that to a certain extent. But that is one of the huge benefits to Maryland of the Medicare waiver. This is hard to see, but maybe on your hard copy you could see it. Back in 1980, and that was the base that was negotiated in 85 for the waiver test, we were 30% higher on a payment per case basis for inpatient. And we started to do a little better than the U.S. The U.S. is in yellow in that period where we had both DRGs and the volume adjustment system. But then it started to get away from us, and then you see it flattens out for the United States. I think that was maybe balanced budget amendment time in the late 90s. And then we had to bend the curve back down. But as long as we stayed less than 30% higher than the U.S. in payment, we got to keep the waiver. That was the structure of the waiver test. And as I said, it was very fortuitous to Maryland. And today, Medicare pays these higher amounts, Medicaid pays these higher amounts, and it's worth about $2.3
billion. You skipped the last bullet.
Sorry. Yeah, it's sort of an obvious point. I mean, how could any state, if you go in, it's not that you couldn't negotiate a waiver now. I think it's potentially feasible, although with the Trump administration, there'll be more challenges. But the idea is that Medicare's not going to pay more than they're paying now in any case when they negotiate a waiver. They would negotiate a waiver deal where they would look to save money.
Sure.
And that's kind of the structure that they negotiated in Vermont. It's not an actual Medicare waiver, but for Medicare to be a participant, Vermont has to save a very small amount of money in terms of per capita Medicare growth over time. So Medicare is going to be looking to save money, not subsidize the system like they're doing with Maryland. And no one would ever really want to talk about this. And I tried to talk about it in a judicious way when I was at the commission. But I think this is a dynamic that's very important for everyone to understand. We have a very favorable arrangement.
Do you think there's any chance for something analogous to what Oregon did with our Medicaid waiver, where we committed to reducing the rate of cost growth in Medicaid, but got an infusion of money up front to help enable that?
Yeah, but not anywhere close to the amount that you got for the Medicaid waiver. Just as a point of comparison, Vermont has to reduce Medicare per capita growth by 0.2% relative to national growth over, I think, like a five-year period. There are a lot of contingencies and caveats that are built in there. They got $9 million in upfront funding.
$9 million?
Million. So that's the deal that CMMI negotiated with Vermont. Now, Vermont's a much smaller state, and Medicare is a low per capita expenditure there, but they're not going to add whatever it is, 100 and you got just tremendous amounts of money. My hat was off to the governor for negotiating that, but you won't get the same sort of equation, in my opinion. Performance for the time I was there, after Hal Cohen left, the executive director started to negotiate away the volume adjustment system with many hospitals, so that it was really, if some hospitals went to 100% variable cost, you didn't have that 50% marginal cost factor that adjusted rates. Most of the other hospitals went to, and this gets complicated, but it was a very dilute volume adjustment system after 1992. I came in 93, 94, and we started to notice that hospitals' costs were starting to accelerate. Their profitability was off the charts in the mid-90s. And then there was a balanced budget act in 97, so we started running into trouble on our waiver test. And we had a period of very stringent updates. In fact, one year we had a negative update. I don't think anybody's done a negative update since 98, 99. We also were convinced unfortunately, that with the rise of managed care, that we didn't have to worry about hospital volumes, that the HMOs would take care of it, they were managing it. And so we eliminated the volume adjustment system in 2001 and went to 100% variable cost. Now, the hospitals, I think in particular, reacting to this period of very tight inflation updates, saw this as an opportunity where they could do more volumes and help, you know, their financials by doing more volumes. And indeed, that is what happened in the mid-2000 period. This is there's an article, and there's a reference to the article. I co-authored it. But you can see in that period when we had DRGs and the volume adjustment system, volume growth was very about 0.8% per year. It's about a little more than population growth in Maryland. And then when we got rid of the volume adjustment system, that's the behavioral response we saw, a huge increase in numbers of cases and also outpatient volumes. So you have to be careful. Yes.
Did you say why you went away from the volume adjustment? Or was it just
The reason why was we were focused on negotiating very tough updates for their per cost. And our waiver test was a per case. So we were focused on per case, controlling per case cost growth. And we thought managed care is taking hold. They will manage the volume and utilization review. And the hospitals convinced us that that was going to be the case. And we made a bad decision. It had already been diluted significantly at that point. So I went from a 15% variable cost to zero, 15% adjustment to they were getting 100 cents on the dollar for new volume. And that's what resulted. So this was not lost on us. We tried to get the volume adjustment back in, but the industry just strongly opposed getting the volume adjustment back in. We were going to incrementally, you know, phase it up back to 50%. But then there was a lot more discussion about health reform and moving more to population-based systems. And we had previously been aware of the Rochester area demonstration. In fact, had a couple of global budget hospitals in the early days in rate setting. And so we started proposing more bundled fixed payment mechanisms to try to get at this issue of volume growth. And one of them was to bring back the volume adjustment system, what the industry opposed, but then develop a admission, readmission, episode-based payment in 2011. And we implemented a series of global budgets for 10 rural hospitals in 2009, 2010. And the idea behind that is that the rural hospitals are good candidates if they're big enough to assume that risk because their populations are naturally mapped to them. So it's almost like a shadow capitation arrangement where they're under a cap. They know that they get this fixed amount of money. Now the idea is they should be, you know, the quid pro quo is they should use it effectively, reduce unnecessary costs, and treat their patient population as effectively as possible. If they were to invest in primary care, they would reduce unnecessary admissions. They'd keep the money under their cap, and that would be a source of financial sustainability. That was kind of the equation that we worked on. And 10 hospitals said yes. We provided some upfront infrastructure money to help them with some of these care management and these transitionary strategies for more population-based health. And they've been in place for that period of time. And then we thought this would be kind of a precursor of some new model that we would look to negotiate with CMS.
How large generally were those hospitals? You said earlier your rural.
Yeah, well, we had the benefit of having larger rural hospitals. One was about $15 million. The global budget has not worked for that hospital. They're just too small. And there would be times when the equation of the global budgets, and I'll show you, is that as volumes, so they get a fixed amount, $16 million. As their volumes decline, they have to raise their prices because to get to $16 million of charged revenue, it's volume times price. So that hospital, as their volume started to decline, they had rates that were comparable to Johns Hopkins. You know, so it just was not, or conversely, if they would get a spike in volume, they would go out of business.
You'll probably get to it, but I'd be interested in sort of the, if there's a chart in your mind of how big a hospital needs to be for this to be effective.
Yeah, I think my colleague that I worked with, one, we actually did some work for the Hospital Association around how to structure payment for the A and B hospitals here for the Medicaid program. And we looked at could the state put some of these hospitals under global budgets. And most of the A and Bs are too small, I think, to put under global budgets. There are things that you can do, put stop loss provisions and things of that nature in, but it would be tricky. And you'd really have to think about the risk associated with doing that.
I think we have more small hospitals than we have more small.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
But they're all. But just so you know, they're all aligned with somebody big. There's very little standalone left.
I think you're having people say not all of them.
Most.
No, but I mean, in my experience, most of the quote small hospitals are partnered with something else. They're not
most. So, does the global budget include Medicare, Medicaid, and
commercial?
So all of those payments. So it's not just Medicare.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was, whereas some of these other global budget systems like Pennsylvania, it's all voluntary. They have to voluntarily get the private sector to pay, and Medicare will do it as long as they're saving money. And so it's all. Whereas this is mandated. So we had the benefit of, and the hospitals loved it because they had a predictable stream of revenue, and then they could say, for the most part, they did initially, wow, we don't have to worry about generating referrals, and now we can focus on our populations. There's one hospital, Western Maryland. There was a good article, I should have sent you the link, in the New York Times about Western Maryland Health System, and they've done a pretty good, very good job, I think the most admirable job of focusing on population-based health. But then the other constraint that hospitals have is that the physicians are not on a global type of payment. And so the extent to which the hospital's reducing admissions or procedures, the physicians' incomes suffer. And so if you're a hospital CEO and you're highly dependent on your physicians, you're doing that, it's problematic. And that's a bit of the dynamic that we've seen in the Maryland system. Hospitals have not reduced utilization as much as we expected, and we think that's part of the dynamic. Yes?
Do many of the systems have a highly employed physician base, or...
Yeah, I believe so, and it's increased over time. They have contracts largely with the ologists that they negotiate, but they've increased their... Maryland was characterized as having predominantly independent physician practices, but it's over the last 10 years, the hospital's gone out and purchased a lot of practices.
And then second question, how in this model do you deal with site of service? So... Because you could have a scenario where, I mean, more and more things are moving to an outpatient setting, an ambulatory surgery center. How is that addressed in this global?
Well, that was something we were a bit concerned about, that it would create an incentive for people, for hospitals to shed services, and indeed it has. And we've seen some of that with certain health systems more than others. And the commission still retains the right to go in and rebase a global budget. Generally, the system's prospective, and we never rebase. But when there's a circumstance where we could see a concerted effort to shift diagnostic lab or procedures out to a freestanding, unregulated center, the commission has the ability to go in and readjust the global budget for that. So that's generally how the commission has tried to address those sorts of issues.
And that type of... ASCs, et cetera, are unregulated.
They're unregulated, yes. Now, there's another interesting point to your question I'll bring up. I'll talk about this later, which is that even under this fixed system, you're going to get shifts in market share. You know, referrals, Kaiser, the CareFirst PCMH, their physicians are incentivized to refer to lower cost, higher quality hospitals. And if a hospital, one of those lower cost, high quality hospitals is under a fixed global budget, they're going to be disadvantaged by this shift in patient volume. So there needs to be some type of system to account for that. And that's been tricky, and I'll get into that in a minute. So those are the responses, and you know, the cost containment, try to improve that, but also because of, you know, moving more toward this population-based health concept and maybe expanding out into controlling total cost of care. We also, because we were worried about these fixed budgets creating incentive for hospitals to stint on care, in 2008, 2009, we developed two or three payment programs around quality. One was, here we are. Quality-based reimbursements like the federal value-based payment program, where they look at clinical indicators, patient safety indicators, patient satisfaction, and we provide incremental rewards and penalties based on individual hospital performance. So a hospital could get a rate update to their global budgets of 2.5%, and they might get another 0.5% if they do well on some of these, or they might have 0.5% shaved off if they're not doing well. We also did a fairly extensive version of the federal hospital acquired condition, the HAC program. We used a much broader array of complications and hospital-acquired conditions than the feds, but we also did this incremental plus-minus. And then we had a readmission program. As I said, it was kind of a bundled program. But the idea was to try to raise the bar on quality so that the hospitals kept a focus on that as well, including patient satisfaction. So with the passage of the ACA, we contacted our colleagues in CMS and CMMI. They were very interested in trying to negotiate something with us. It was consistent with population-based health. We were on the verge of losing our original Medicare waiver for a variety of reasons. The idea is that when you start to create more of a fixed payment system, you shed the lower cost readmissions. They're not admitted now, so the remaining ones are higher, so that jacked up our per case. The state also imposed a Medicaid provider tax on the system, which Medicare pays, which I couldn't believe they went along with that, but they did. That also eroded our... and I said the waiver was in statute, so their hands were tied, I guess. That eroded our performance, so we were on the verge of losing our waiver. And the idea, and for the feds, they were happy, okay, we'll negotiate a new waiver, take it out of statute, make it a demonstration waiver. So that was the quid pro quo for negotiating. And Maryland swallowed pretty hard in doing that, but we thought the advantages... would outweigh the disadvantages, you know, moving to a new system and having better incentives. Our staff's original thought was that we wouldn't put global budgets on all the hospitals because you run into issues of hospitals in urban, suburban areas not serving an identifiable patient population. There's overlapping service areas, and we just thought that would be too complicated. So what we were trying to do is move back to a 50% variable cost factor because that system had worked very well in at least forestalling population or volume growth, and then try to put global budgets on as many hospitals as we could, or even groups of hospitals. Like in the district, you have Holy Cross and you've got Washington Adventist and Shady Grove. Those three hospitals could be under a regional cap, potentially. So that was our thought process. It's all consistent with a three-part aim. The Department of Health and others were supportive because they didn't want to lose the waiver, largely. So that was the impetus for this. And so in 2013, the state negotiated the new model. It started January 1st of 14. The advantage for the feds is that they got the waiver out of statute. It was now at the discretion of CMS as to whether it continued or not. And they imposed these per capita growth limitations on the state, moved away from the per case growth to an all-payer per capita growth limitation per year. It was really a cumulative over 5 years, but the number that was used was an average growth per capita over a 10-year period from 2002 to 2012. And as long as we kept the all-payer per capita per Maryland resident growth below that 3.58, we passed that test. There was also a test related to per capita Medicare hospital savings over 5 years that we had to eke out at least $330 million of Medicare savings, that is, grow less rapidly on the Medicare per capita cost relative to the nation. It's not a huge amount of savings, but as you know, Medicare nationally has been pretty tight. So we met that, and that also conferred benefits to Medicaid and also the private sector, because if we're growing at the fairly tight national growth rate in Medicare, that also means that we're growing at a very low rate for other payers. And then there was a nominal, they call them guardrails, for total cost of care, where we were not to grow faster than the U.S. on Medicare total cost of care. That includes physicians, freestanding, pharmaceuticals, long-term care, as well as acute care hospital. And there were provisions where we couldn't grow more than the U.S. by 1% in any year, or more than the U.S. in 2 years consecutive, any amount above. And if we failed on any of these tests, there was a triggering event. There had to be a corrective action plan filed. And if it wasn't satisfactory, the CMS could terminate the waiver. If we terminated the waiver, we had 2 years to transition to the federal payment system, IPPS, OPPS. And that would mean the loss of the additional federal payments. And two-year transition would have been catastrophic and very difficult. We estimated that had we lost the waiver, transitioned to IPPS and the lower federal and state payments for Medicare and Medicaid, and the hospitals could have cost-shifted that shortfall to the private sector, the premiums would have gone up over 10% over a two-year period. Now, it would not end up being that way, because CareFirst is a very large payer, and there would be that power play that would take place in negotiations between the individual hospital systems and CareFirst and the other payers. But you would get some degree of cost shifting and rapid increase in premiums if we lost the waiver. We also were required to do some performance on the quality side. We had to reduce our Medicare readmission rate to at or below the U.S. average. We're very high. We're the second highest jurisdiction in readmission rates. And some of that is a function of where we are. On the East Coast, the readmission rates are high. But also some of that was hospitals had the incentive to do more volumes, so we had more readmissions. And then we had to reduce our rate of hospital-acquired conditions by 30% over 5 years, which we thought was doable, because we had been reducing at about that magnitude prior to the demonstration. And we put that program in 2009, and we were getting 8 to 9% reductions every year in acquired complications. And then the QBR just had to have performance that was commensurate with the value-based purchasing. Just talk a little bit about this idea of population-based health. The demonstration waiver, the new model, said you also have to shift 90% of your revenue in the system to a population-based health payment system. It defined population-based health as either where you're assigning a population and their cost to a particular provider, so like an ACO where you attribute patients and their budget is based on that attribution, or an HMO like Kaiser, where you identify the patient and there's a PMPM type of structure developed, or a fixed global budget. So that gave us kind of an out, where we could impose fixed global budgets on the rest of the hospitals. And that's what the new staff did, is they just sat down and said, Hopkins, you're $2.1 billion, that's your budget. University of Maryland, you're $1.6 billion, that's your budget. And went systematically based on what their historical budgets were in 2013. That was the base year. And then now instead of the unit payment being updated by inflation or the per case payment being updated by inflation, the global budget's updated by inflation each and every year. And that's all they get. And so then you get these dynamics where, well, there's an incentive to shift some patients out of the regulated system. Hopkins didn't want their out-of-state business part of their global budget. And so there are those sorts of dynamics that you have to get. But it's a 100% fixed system. And in the first year, the staff, I have to give them a lot of credit, they negotiated fixed global budgets for the remaining 40-some hospitals, or 38 hospitals. And that system has been in place despite the fact that you have these volume shifts.
Question?
Yes.
So in that fixed system, did the public notice any decrease in access for higher specialty services that hospitals may have once provided that then became unsustainable?
I think that there probably were some peripheral effects like that, which the public probably did notice. I'm not sure to what extent they understood the cause and effect enough to be able to complain to the commission. It would be a good question to ask the people at the HSCRC now. I know there were a couple of hospitals that sort of did, without providing much notice, shut down some services, like an OB service, and there was more subtle, I've just heard this anecdotally, so this is not proven, but subtle evidence of some hospitals and hospital systems not rehiring some of their physicians, and so that will cause them to lose referrals. So you at least have had some of that occur. Now, whether it's been noticeable enough for the public to say, what's going on, you're stinting on care, I don't think it has at this stage in any dramatic way. But also, I'm sure the commission put hospitals on notice where they said, look, if we get word that this is happening, we're going to call you in and you're going to have to explain what's going on here or we're going to reduce your budget. So the commission has that autonomy to do that. And hospitals don't want to, have this stuff publicized. And it's, so there have been some checks and balances, but it's a concern.
In the new model that you have, is the is part of the population-based really a narrowing down of the network then to ensure you have the ability to control cost?
When you say narrowing down about the network, I'm not sure.
Well, I know traditional Medicare, you're not, that's going to be open access.
Right.
But in the commercial market, in order to control cost, you try to narrow down the network. So you're only working with a group of physicians, whatever, that share sort of that same vision. And so you'll see the more narrower products then come in order to control costs.
Well, from an insurer standpoint, certainly there's that incentive to create a narrower network and preferred providers. And I don't know that this has changed that strategy per se. I'm not sure what the hospitals individually, their strategies are with regard to their physicians. I can say I'm really surprised. I have a colleague that negotiates a lot of contracts between hospitals and physicians, and surprisingly, the structure of those contracts haven't changed. That they were originally bring them in, guaranteed contract, 2 years, then put them on performance-based productivity payment where they're paid more for more volume, which is completely diametrically opposed to the incentives under the global budget. And I it's like, what you should think out of the box here. How could you, couldn't you partner or with your employed physicians, provide incentives, not for them to stint on care, but there'd be quality measures, and then you would align the incentives. But so far, I don't think it's been done in earnest. So it takes a while to move in this direction. I guess they're still struggling with that. This is, I'm sorry you can't see this very well, but this is the kind of the simplistic aspect of the global budget. Administratively, it's a lot easier than the old system. I start out with this Washington County Hospital, more isolated. It's in Hagerstown, the center of the state. They serve about 150,000 residents. And $250 million in the base year, we update it for inflation, what their factor costs are increasing at. 2.5%, we increase it for the demographic change, and that's both population change and also aging the population. And I said here, just an example, that's 1.15%. Their new budget then is $259 million. And if they're able to reduce readmissions, admissions, or otherwise reduce costs, become more efficient, they keep the money under that, and that's at least theoretically, a strong incentive to try to move in that direction. Plus, there were monies put in without strings, unfortunately, but for hospitals to try to invest in their communities. And that would be a good, Western Maryland would be a great hospital to reach out to because they really did take that seriously and did invest more in population-based health, based on my experience.
In this model, just one other question. How is capital handled? To ensure that you don't.
Yeah. Well, that's been a source of debate. In the previous system, hospitals could apply for additional money for capital if they had an approved CON. And in general, we'd always have this debate with hospitals. We say, look, we set your costs, your rates based on your costs. Your capital costs were in there. Certainly, your replacement costs are in there. So the former executive director used to call it the RAGU system, which is, it's in there. And so we'd have this debate back and forth. But for big scale projects, particularly if it was approved by the Planning Commission, we would have the hospital file a rate application, and if their capital costs were below some peer group averages, they could be moved up to the peer group average and receive some additional funding for capital projects. Under the new system, they're really going back to the RAGU system, which is it's in there. And it may be that for if there was a new big CON, but right now, the hospitals are not looking to build new facilities under this structure as readily. So it will be a bit of a debate, an ongoing debate, but in general, the bias of the regulator is you've got your money, you want to build something new, go back and reduce utilization. That's your source of financing for new, you know, projects.
Can I ask a question
related?
What is the environment of the electronic medical record in Maryland? Technology requirements that they have?
Yes. I'm not an expert in that area. I've been told that it's kind of at the physician level, it's a love-hate relationship that they have with, you know, electronic medical records. On one hand, it can provide some benefit. On the other hand, the physicians rightly think it's a major distraction and a big expense. When I was at the commission, we did provide some small amounts in rates to create a fund to try to set up a statewide health information exchange. That got off the ground. Those amounts have been continued as an additional source of financing for them until they become more self-sustaining. And there's been an effort, I'm not an expert on it, but there's been an effort to link all the electronic medical records into that so that it could be supportive of population-based health. So there is a movement, and that is certainly with the total cost of care model requirement, is to have a more robust information system, statewide information system, that can support the movement to total cost of care. But that's been a challenge. And again, I think the folks at the commission could comment a lot more expertly on that. Just a word a little bit on performance. As I said, they met the global budget requirement of having 90% of the revenue under global budgets by mid-2014, right off the bat. Hospitals were given significant infrastructure adjustments in 14 to go on the global budget, 15, 16, and they've retained those funds. I have to say, not as significant of the amount that we gave the original 10 TPR hospitals. We gave them probably way too much, but there have been infusions in the new model. The first year was very favorable, which is important because if you're looking at bending the curve, the more you can generate savings in the first year, and even if you were to parallel the U.S., you keep racking up those savings in the first year, each and every year. And so I think that wasn't lost on the commission. They did generate savings the first year. 15 and 16, they added more infrastructure money funding to rates. The performance was less favorable. We beat the all-payer test easily, in part because that 3.58 limit was developed at a time when there was very high inflation, and we benefited by, you know, relatively low inflation, general inflation in the economy since. We also beat the commission and the system outperformed the Medicare hospital tests and generated over $330 million, projected to be close to $500 million. There are many, particularly the payer representatives, who think that's like just barely meeting the target, that we should be able to generate a lot more savings than that. On the total cost of care, we were under in 14, over in 15, under in 16, we'll probably be over in 17, probably not over by more than 1%. That was one of the triggering events. But then there's a concern that we'll be over in 17 and 18, which is would be a triggering event, which is raising some concern. That would be problematic as we move into the new model, the second phase of the new model. Hospital profitability was very robust during this period. You can see regulated margins are quite high. These are averages. Although, at the end of the day, hospitals lose money largely on physician practices so that they kind of, in my experience, sort of equilibrate things so that they're making at least a 3-3.5% margin, you know, for bond rating purposes. So generally good performance. As I said, easily beat the 3.58. We're meeting the $330 million, I think, generating maybe close to $550 million in total savings up through 18. Mixed performance on total cost of care, and then there's a concern about what happens in phase two if we're not performing well on total cost of care. We don't have regulatory authority over non-hospital. So if we're not meeting the total cost of care test, the HSCRC would have to ratchet down the hospital rates. And that would erode support for the waiver. Quality programs, they brought the readmission rate down pretty significantly and are on target to be at the national average by 2018. Hospital-acquired conditions, there's some debate about what happened here. The performance target was 30% drop over 5 years. In the first 3 years, we saw 47% drop. And so there's some concern about what's driving that. The financial incentives changed completely for the hospitals. So some concern about did they change how they document and code secondary diagnoses and conditions. So is this a behavioral response to changes in the financial incentives? So that we haven't been able to sort that one out. Quality-based reimbursement has been somewhat mixed. Maryland's traditionally had very, very poor patient satisfaction ratings. I mean, some of that's regional when you look at the United States. But we've been an outlier, and it hasn't gotten better. In fact, we have very, very high ED wait times that have probably gotten worse since the beginning of the demonstration. So they're, you know, it's a little bit of a mixed bag. I think in general, it's been successful. Impact, hospitals still are supportive. Margins remain strong. There's disappointment, certainly in the payer community, that there hasn't been more reduction in focus on managing care and utilization. But, you know, it's challenging for the hospitals for the reasons that I mentioned. The private payers have benefited tremendously from the presence of the waiver because Medicare and Medicaid pay much higher. And as a result, you know, the private sector over time has not had to pay as much through cost shifting, but also has benefited from the lower rates of growth of the rate setting system over time. The state supports generally, the Medicaid department doesn't, you know, sort of grouses at having to pay hospital rates, which are higher. But then they did pass this 3% provider tax to sort of plug a budget hole. And then what is the galvanizing force is the $2.3 billion of Medicare savings, which I mentioned if it were taken out would probably raise premiums by 10%. And then we'd lose that mechanism for funding uncompensated care. Other challenges, as I said before, and to get to, I think, some of the points raised, global budgets are rigid. So there hasn't been a mechanism to really account for these market shifts. There was a market shift adjustment mechanism put in place in 2015, but it's not been very satisfactory to the hospitals. It's been very complicated, subject to instability. So there's some discord associated with that. There's also concern about the system getting too complicated. I mean, certainly we would get these complaints too, and we're probably guilty of coming up with very complicated systems. But the problems with creating complicated incentive systems is it obscures the incentives so that hospitals don't know how to respond, what the cause and effect is. That dynamic, as Oliver probably has read, undermined a lot of the other rate-setting systems. New York became so complicated, nobody understood it. Like John McDonough, who's a researcher, said the New York system was a source of dark humor about how complicated it was, and the same with New Jersey. So that's the balance. You want to keep things as simple as possible, but there's some concern that things have become too complicated. General concerns about somebody coming in at the federal level saying, that's it, we're taking this out. Because it's at the discretion of CMS to keep the waiver. The phase two presents a huge challenge because it's oriented around total cost of care. The commission has tried to develop some methodologies to help the hospitals manage the cost of their communities. There is a program called the Maryland Primary Care Program. It's still on the drawing boards. It's modeled after the federal comprehensive primary care plus model nationally. Our fear from payers' perspective is the incentives are just not strong enough. And so there's a concern about whether these models really will be robust enough to control, they're untested largely, to control total cost of care. There is some discussion now about bringing the Care First model, which has been in existence for 6 years, into play and expanding it into Medicare. That would, if it was successful, that would be a proven model that could help address this issue. But the current update, and I'm getting close to the witching hour here, so is that the expectation is that CMS will approve phase two by the end of this year, beginning of next. There would be two phases to the phase two. First 5 years, the performance guidelines are pretty well specified. The second 5 years is just contemplated. There would be this total cost of care focus, looking at rates of growth there. And right now, Maryland is they're being asked to generate $1 billion in savings in total cost of care over 5 years, which sounds like a lot of money, but on a base of paying an extra 10-plus billion, it sort of puts it in perspective. But at the same time, if we were to grow at the national rate of growth on total cost of care applicable to all payers, that would be an accomplishment, a real accomplishment. Quality program goals haven't been reestablished, and they need to be. And there also need to be population-based quality metrics that are identified and brought into the system. So, summary. Now you know how my commissioners felt at each commission meeting. So we got to the waiver can't be duplicated in its entirety because of this dynamic. You might be able to negotiate a waiver, but it would start out current system and you'd have to generate savings. There may be some upfront funding, but it won't be significant. The difficulty also, too, I think, with the current administration, although I've been told that we got some traction with CMS by sort of characterizing the waiver as a Medicare block grant. That the current administration loves block grants, and so we said that's what this is. You don't have to worry. You've block granted us, and so there is some receptivity there. So it's a strategy that could be considered. Advantages. So just to kind of wrap it up, well-developed flexible systems did succeed. You'll see the literature basically says that when rate setting was first started and robust and not challenged, it was effective in controlling costs. And Maryland, I would argue, has generally been effective. So you can control at least a fairly major portion of the health spend, not all health spend. You have this worry about out-migration from what you're regulating. It could be a starting point, but no state has really solved the total cost of care conundrum yet, although I think Maryland's made progress. elements could be adopted, like on a regional basis. There are articles which I can send you about Rochester. It really was a pretty successful experiment. And they also included Finger Lake hospitals. There are six Finger Lake facilities. Vermont is attempting a version of this. I worked on some of the Vermont global budget models for hospitals in 2014 and 2015. They're contemplating a much larger superstructure with ACOs run by a provider organization. So there are a lot of ifs and ands about how they're approaching this, but there is information available that you can see on the web. Negatives about hospital update a rate setting system, enormous effort, and both the intellectual capital you need to develop and also the data collection and the infrastructure. You need a Medicare waiver, I think, and that would at least prevent further cost shifting and then create a more equitable system moving forward. Systems that didn't have waivers and Jack Keane can comment on this because they didn't have a waiver initially in Massachusetts. They did negotiate one later. But I think a waiver would be a requirement. And so there are concerns about being able to negotiate a waiver. Hospital care is shrinking proportion of the total health spend. So if you're only controlling that, there's a question, is there a leakage? And then the absence of current programs to control total cost of care. If you want my solution to health care, it's single payer nationally. That's the only thing that's going to save us. So with that, I will end, and you can boot me out of the room. Thank you. Any other last questions?
Question there?
With the increasing threat of high-cost generic brand-name specialty pharmaceuticals, what percentage of Maryland's total cost of care from a hospital perspective was attributed to pharmaceuticals? And is Maryland looking at any statewide pharmacy formularies?
I don't know the percentage. I know that particularly for the biologics and for other high-cost drugs, for the academic centers and the cancer centers and the shock trauma, that drugs are a huge problem now. And I don't know what proportion, but there was an article in Health Affairs that showed national health expenditure growth just a couple weeks ago, and drugs were up 12% in 14 and 9% in 15. Interestingly, in 16 they were not up anywhere close to that. But you've got these huge jump up and then off of that base. I don't want to venture a guess. I can get that information for you. What proportion? That is, it's a major, major issue for the hospitals, particularly under global budgets. Yeah. The commission did try to build in an additional inflation factor for them, for hospitals that had high proportions of high-cost drugs. It's another example of kind of trying to deal with it locally, but they're passing through some of it. Not all of it. They want the hospitals to still negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies, supply companies, as much as possible. But it's a problem that hasn't been addressed. And I don't know from what the state is looking to do from a formulary standpoint. Jerry Anderson told me, actually, I know you're getting in touch with him, that there was legislation last year in Maryland to form some type of commission to try to regulate drug prices in the state. And I don't know how they would go about doing that, but Jerry would be somebody to ask about that.
They're working on possible legislation for next year on that right now.
Yeah. Jerry was involved in that, and so Jesse obviously has some knowledge. To the extent that they would be successful, I don't know what they could do. A key problem there is that Medicare is missing in action and just fails to take the lead and negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies. So, any other last questions?
Yeah. The last one. So we talked a little bit about, Oregon has a higher number of smaller hospitals, some of which are associated with
right.
systems, and we have, I think, 25 critical access hospitals where Maryland has none.
How many?
25, I think.
Really? Is it that many? 25, okay, wow. And then remind me again, I know there's an A-B designation. Are the Bs the critical access and the As are just, no, the other way around?
No, it's a mix. The A's and B's just differentiates between the number of
distance of
beds.
Oh, okay. All right, I should know that.
Cost-based.
But there are 25. I didn't realize there were that many.
Yeah. So I guess now I have two questions. One is, what concerns does that that number raise for you? And two, are there other differences between Maryland and Oregon that you think we'll need to contemplate as we move forward in this process?
Well, I think because you've got smaller hospitals in general, you have to be very concerned about what type of payment system you put in so you're not transferring too much risk to those facilities. Even a DRG-based payment system, when we looked at this for the association, would likely transfer too much risk to these small facilities because you get these variations in morbidity and mortality year to year that can skew the distributions and create financial problems. So we had recommended for Medicaid a unit rate system with a volume adjustment because that would get at, you know, sort of neutralizing the incentives to do more volumes, but transfer some risk to the hospitals for controlling their unit costs. And so there are variations on all of these themes that could be adapted to a particular environment, I guess would be my answer to you. But be concerned about the risk transfer. And, you know, just because we were able to do global budgets for rural hospitals doesn't mean that that's the solution for rural hospitals in the United States. You'd have to think about it. And then what was the second part of your question?
Based on what you know about our system in Oregon, are there other key differences that we'll need to keep in mind as we kind of move forward in this process? So,
I don't know that much about the configuration of, for instance, like the consolidation of hospitals here. I know I wrote a pretty big report on this back in 2012 about growing hospital consolidation and then the impact on charges, particularly out-of-network charges. My general sense is you're probably not as consolidated as we are, so that's a good thing. But that would be something that you'd want to keep your eye on, both from an antitrust standpoint and also regulatory standpoint. I think you have a big advantage because you have more of an emphasis on prevention than we do. The practice of medicine on the West Coast is very different than it is on the East Coast. You have lower length of stay here. You have lower admission rates here, generally. You have lower costs. It's just you don't, from a policy standpoint, be careful about things that would cause hospitals to want to consolidate more and use their market leverage than to, you know, drive up charges to the private sector, because then you'll start to become like Massachusetts and Pittsburgh. And those are just very problematic circumstances. So I'd be very wary of that. Now, there are regulatory things you could try to do to mitigate, and I think you've done some of that, you know, like some of the balanced billing legislation that you put in. You know, I'd focus on that. I don't know how you are in terms of focus and emphasis on primary care, but that would be another area to kind of look at. In Maryland, we have a lot of independent primary care physicians. There are not as many that are owned and operated by hospitals, so that's an advantage. But the more that hospitals get into that business, then they sort of transform the incentives of the primaries to redirect referrals, so you'd want to kind of look at that. I could try to think of other things. And certainly if you have follow-up questions or other things you'd want me to address, I could try to respond.
Well, one of the differences may be the Medicaid market, because we are, 25% Medicaid,
right?
You're like 15. So what effect would the state have borne? Like, can you quantify how much more the state paid in relationship and or this kind of a model as opposed to?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that we're that much below you, but if you look at, there is one table that showed the proportions. It looks like, at least in 2014, we were at 17, you were at 22 for proportion of the spend.
And you have better reimbursement than we have, right? If I understood that right.
Much higher for Medicaid.
Yeah.
Medicaid.
So you have.
Yeah, well, but the state's paying their share.
Right. So the differential from what the state pays under a higher reimbursement let comparison, because if our state were to come up, that's a pretty.
Well, again, you won't. You negotiate a waiver, Medicaid's going to pay whatever they're paying now. And then and Medicare will pay whatever they're paying now. So the payer differentials will stay the same. They'll just move in unison. So they would move at a common inflation rate. Now, Vermont was hoping that they could move to a system that was regulated and generate savings by putting incentives in to reduce use and so on, and then that some of that savings could be used to increase Medicaid payment, to narrow their differentiated payment. But that would take a long time. And I don't think you'd get the feds to agree to that either. So really, that's the big difference. You know, back to the differences, is that you could start a regulated system, but you'd have private sector paying up here, Medicaid here, and you'd have to keep that those differentials in place as you move forward. But at least you could control potentially, you know, with all these other caveats, bend the curve and try to, you know, moderate the growth and hopefully expand it out to total cost of care. But it's a challenge. So I feel like my life just passed before my eyes. So I hope this doesn't happen again when I actually die. That wasn't my joke, actually. That was a joke I heard earlier. But I would be happy to answer other questions. And I did watch the first one, and I was saying, I can answer that. I can answer that. So anyway, I hope it's been helpful. And
Very helpful.
Thank you. Know, thank you. Enjoyed being out here and seeing my sister. So. But I'm available, but, you know. But Jackie, he's very, very thoughtful.
Okay.
I think he'd be a good person to talk to. So I'll turn the clicker back over to Oliver.
Okay, we'll take a 10-minute break.
That's a good idea.
To order. And I'm going to turn it over to Oliver because the next few items are yours.
Great. Thank you, Jean. So what I want to do is... Again, I think obviously Robert did a really good job in describing a number of the technical aspects of kind of the Maryland model, how hospitals have been paid historically and transitioning to the global payment model, and kind of what the experiences were in Maryland. What I thought would be helpful and what the bill requires us to do specifically is to understand why similar efforts to create a hospital rating set process in Washington and other states failed or were not implemented or withdrawn. And so that's what I thought we could spend the next half hour doing is really spotlighting five other states. They have a number of different models and design considerations, and I'll walk through those and kind of what the history and the story is for those states. Robert also touched a little bit, but I think it's helpful to set the historical context here. And why did we see rate setting in terms of a program as a policy tool to really start to try to constrain cost? And so I have some information here. I think Robert probably touched a little bit on this. So between 65 and 79, hospital inpatient expenditures per year increased 12%. And so this was
per year. Wow.
Was becoming an increasingly large financial issue for states. And then in 1972, you have Congress pass Section 222 of the Social Security Act, giving states the authority to establish rate-setting programs. So that was really opened the door for states to start thinking about rate-setting with the Congressional act that they did. At the same time, and we'll come back to this a little bit, and Robert talked about this, a year later, they also passed another law to foster development of managed care and HMOs. So we see that play out over kind of a two-decade span. And clearly, we all understand that really the goal of rate-setting programs is to contain cost for states and for payers, both publicly and privately. And then the other fundamental change that was occurring in the 1970s from a historical perspective was the shift from the cost-based reimbursement to a prospective reimbursement model. And we heard pretty extensively from Robert what that transition looked like. And then also this transition was tied to creating incentives to get hospitals to move away from some of the volume and really become more efficient in terms of service delivery, to, again, in an effort to contain costs. So I think that's some of the kind of origins in the U.S. Nationally for rate setting. There are really, I think, kind of four or five, in addition to containing costs. What were some of the other benefits that states saw in wanting to consider setting up and establishing rate-setting programs? And these conversations took place among a number of states, and really in the early 70s, was in addition to the cost containment, increasing, again, levels of productivity, but more effectively and efficiently from a cost standpoint, and wanting to reduce the cost shifting among payers, both from public to private. And so you'll see in the models that we walk through, or the states, there is the all-payer concept. Obviously, that was the Maryland. You have Medicaid, Medicare, and you also have the commercial payers. Well, some states also experimented with what they call partial payer models, so not necessarily Medicare at the table, and or maybe not Medicaid, just really a voluntary rate-setting program that really was applicable to the commercial side within a state. And then in 77, you had President Carter propose federal legislation to create a federal cost containment program. 78, the feds did a study called the National Hospital Rate Setting Study that really looked at, if we were to do this nationally at a federal level, what would be the potential savings? So this was something that was considered quite extensively in the late 70s. And then so ultimately what we saw was, by the end of the 1970s of the decade, you had 30 plus states move towards some form and variation of hospital rate setting programs. And because of the different design considerations I'll walk through, they really did vary pretty extensively. So here are the design considerations. Again, think back to Bob's presentation. He walked through, I think, all of these, and each state had to. So let me just kind of go through at a high level what those were. So probably one of the most important design considerations was the payer composition. Was an all-payer? Did the state work with, at the time, HCFA, the federal administration, to get the waiver for Medicare, or was it a partial? And so we'll look at some of the states that used both, or one or the other. And then how extensive? Was it going to be limited in terms of rate setting to just inpatient, or also outpatient as well, or provider services that were provided within a hospital setting? States had to kind of wrestle with some of that. Two facets of the governance question, and you heard about this: New Jersey, New York, when they stood up their hospital rate setting program, it was within their executive agency, so it was stood up in their Department of Health, versus Maryland, Washington, and other states that actually had an independent commission. Often those commissioners were governor appointed, so they had some of that political autonomy, if you will, compared to state executive agencies. And then the payment structure, again, we heard about this. Would they set payment rates per diem, so versus kind of paying by episodes, and then ultimately the global budgets? That really did evolve over the 20-year period in states. As you heard, Maryland, they weren't alone in this. New Jersey, almost every state really changed how they paid and how that factored in the rate setting. And then one of the concerns that states had early on about this, and Robert gets some really good examples, was innovation. States were concerned, if we move to a rate setting program, would this stifle innovation at the hospital level? And so how do you create the right set of incentives, and how do you change those incentives over time to make sure that you're not stifling innovation at the hospital level? And then lastly was the transition period. I think Robert said it was a five-year transition. Most states, it was at least 2 to 3 years to transition into the program. And this was not a quick ramp-up period for any state on this. So the five states that I want to walk through a little bit, and I would ask each of you, if there's questions on specific states, let us know. We can go back and do our homework and bring back, and we'll be able to do a deeper dive in some of these. Obviously, I didn't cover Maryland for the obvious reason. We had Bob here, but I'm also not covering West Virginia, because we would like to have West Virginia also come, because their experience and how they set up their program was considerably different, so I'll give you a nice contrast. And then the other, I think, historical piece that's really important, again, Robert talked about this. In the 70s, states were having a lot of fiscal constraints with the Medicaid budget. So as you think about the hospital cost, states obviously have to pay their portion of the Medicaid expenditures. And so they were looking at rate setting as being a tool to really help, I think, to address what they saw was rising and sustained growth in their Medicaid programs. And then the last piece is this notion of state innovation versus having a federal program. So I think states that move forward were kind of thinking, we can either move forward, design our own programs and have flexibility and innovation and be able to kind of customize our programs compared to having the feds in the late 70s actually consider rolling out a federal program, which I think some states would have argued that would take away their flexibility and wasn't an ideal. So that really, I think, helped drive a lot of those stakeholder-based conversations and willingness within the state in terms of health plans. And the hospitals really sit at the table and figure this out. So those are kind of some of the environmental factors, if you will. At the end, though, by the mid-1990s, even though 30 states had implemented in the 70s, we only have Maryland and West Virginia left. And I'll talk about why those states moved away and shifted away from having a hospital rate program. So let's start with Connecticut, a smaller state, initiated their program in 76, and they wound down the program or discontinued it in 94. So you have 18 years. One caveat that I want to make sure it's clear. I compare this, or the literature, this is all pulled from available empirical literature and the research out there, but the national average on the trends in hospital costs, it will change because of the implementation. So each state, in terms of the average annual savings, in terms of hospital costs for that state, is different and isn't from the national average because of how long the state had the program, if that makes sense. So Connecticut, they had an independent commission appointed by the governor. And what they did was they conducted annual review of hospital costs and budgets. And that's really where they focused, whereas Maryland was much a more formulaic approach and set formulas and had a lot of adjustments. Connecticut had a different approach, and that really requires a lot of extensive staff and time to really go through each individual hospital's budgets and where they're at revenue-wise. They did have mandated compliance in terms of hospitals and payers, the ones that were part of the payment structure, had to comply with that rate, those rates that were set. But they were a partial payer example. Medicare was not part of their hospital rate setting program. And if you look at the period that Connecticut had the program over those 18 years, their average annual increase in hospital costs was almost 12%. Nationally, at the same time, you saw an 11.7% growth. So in terms of one measure of effectiveness is whether or not Connecticut was able really to contain costs relative to national level. I think that's an interesting observation there. Then you move to Massachusetts. They had their program for 16 years. Again, independent commission appointed by governor. They, though, were much more like the Maryland model, where they had a very more formulaic on how they actually set rates. Again, they did annual rate reviews and adjustments. Another example of where they had mandated compliance. And then it was an all-payer, so they had both Medicaid, Medicare, and they had the commercial payers in their state involved as well. In terms of what they saw during the tenure of their program and the average annual increase in hospital costs is about 10.2%. The national average during that same time frame was 12%. So they were able to keep their rate of growth in terms of the annual average costs in hospitals slightly below the national average during that period. New Jersey, 18 years, so they had their program for a fair amount of time. Similar to New York, it was the Department of Health, much more formula-driven. And I would say, as Bob alluded to, both Maryland and New Jersey really were the two states at the forefront of creating the DRG model and moving to that, and then ultimately got rolled out by at the federal level in 1983. So. But they were kind of the two innovator states that came up with how do you pay by case mix and group of services. They rate adjusted annually for inflation, and they did have a lot more of an intricate program in terms of on that second under the structure, a lot of changes in the payer mix, patient volume. So they really had a number of adjustment factors that they could do for the individual hospitals. It was an all-payer mix until 1989. They weren't meeting their Medicare thresholds, and so the feds took their Medicare waiver away as of 89. And then, as you can see, 3 years later, the program was ended. In terms of the trend in hospital costs, the average annual in New Jersey during that period was 10.7, and the average was 11.2, so they were about 0.5% lower annually in terms of their hospital costs relative to the national average. New York, almost a quarter of a century. They had 25 years worth of experience in that state. Department of Health ran that. They didn't have an independent commission. They originally set per diem rates, but then they did transition in 88 to the DRG-based system for setting rates. It was an all-payer. One of the things that's interesting in terms of a contrast, New York, relative to Maryland, where the Medicaid, Medicare, and the commercial, it was all the same payment. The private payers, even though they set rates, they paid higher rates in the New York model relative to the Medicare and Medicaid. So there was that differential between public and private, in contrast to the Maryland. In terms of what did they see in trends in their hospital costs, the average annual increase in New York was 8.5 compared to the national, which was 9.5 during that period that they had the program. So they were about 1% lower than the average. And then the last state that I thought would be helpful to look at, because it's called in the bill, but it's also our neighbor to the north, is what did Washington do? And so they had their program for about a 14-year period. It was an independent commission, and they did those similar. They reviewed each hospital's cost and revenue, which was less formulaic in terms of what they did. But they also did have mandated compliance. It was a partial payer model again. They did not have Medicare over the duration of the program as one of the key payers that they were able to rate set for. And then last, trends in the hospital costs. The average annual increase in Washington was 13.7. The national was 12.5. So you can see, I think, in terms of the effectiveness of the Washington experience. I added this slide because I think I just went through the left-hand columns, if you will, but what you can see are the far right columns, which I think are also interesting. You can see the increase in state in the rate setting after they went away with the model. So, for example, in Connecticut, starting in 1995, the average annual increase in the hospital spending was 2.3% once they ended the program, and then the U.S. Average was 3.5. And you can kind of go down as well. Washington, again, after they ended the rate setting, was 5.3 their annual increase in hospital cost. Nationally, it was 5.4. So it kind of gives you a kind of during the rate setting what the impact was under a rate setting, and then after when those states no longer supported a rate setting. Again, you don't see anything for Maryland or West Virginia because those two states have maintained their hospital rate setting programs. So I think there are some important trends or factors to call out in terms of why states shifted away from rate setting. This really happened in the 80s and 90s. Again, something that Robert talked about, you really saw the rise of managed care in HMOs. And so I think the thought was, well, this is more of a market-oriented approach. And so thus, let's let managed care really be a new factor that would help drive down costs in healthcare. And that really was, and then we saw the preferred provider organizations in the 90s. An interesting question that raised for states that had rate setting is, well, if we want managed care to do what we think one of the values that managed care brings is to negotiate lower rates, if we're setting those rates, that really ties managed care's hands and HMOs, because we're setting those rates and you're not allowing managed care organizations to negotiate even lower rates potentially, which they had the opportunity to do. You also saw Medicare implement their DRG system nationwide in 83. So again, for states that were already doing DRGs, now you had the feds moving there. And so I think it really kind of changed the calculus in terms of the value of maintaining these programs. And then you did have some states that had a voluntary approach. I think the degree of the effectiveness of being able to kind of contain the rate of growth was a little bit more limited. And then the other big thing I think that you saw in the 80s was a national shift towards deregulation, not just in healthcare, but in a number of different other industries. And so that really, I think, also was an important piece. Some historical observations. Again, we kind of went through this, but Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York, they did experience a decrease in their rate of growth in their hospital costs compared to the national average. Connecticut and Washington, they did not. They actually saw an increase. Don't want to draw too much of a conclusion from that, but I think those are just two interesting data points to think about. And then you did see an evolution of how hospitals were being paid for services evolve over time. A couple of important characteristics that states, you kind of can group states that had rate setting programs and states that did not. There's really four of them, and this is stuff that Roberts published pretty extensively on, is, again, you saw an increase in the state's Medicaid expenditure, so they were turning towards rate setting as a way to really try to slow that rate of growth. You saw a large presence of the Blue Cross plans. So as we heard in Maryland, they had a sizable market share, and you saw that in the other states. You didn't see a number of commercial players within a state, as usually you had a high penetration rate of a Blue Cross plan or multiple higher population densities. That's why you see the East Coast. You heard Connecticut and Maryland compared to larger states. And then lastly, higher hospital beds and physicians per capita in those states. So I think those are important things to be thoughtful of why we saw the certain states go with rate setting compared to other states that did not. And then a gradual erosion of support among payers that really happened in almost all the states for the reasons that kind of I've highlighted this morning. And I think the last piece, the last two things just to call out on this slide is the complexities of these programs increased year to year. And I think a lot of states were just challenged by how complex these programs evolved, as obviously we heard from Bob in Maryland. And so I think because of the shifting landscape that was happening in the 80s, states just moved away from the complexities of having these programs and wanted to see where managed care and kind of the more free market approach could really help further contain cost. And then you did see a number of political, economic, and institutional factors kind of play in here as well, and it really was a move towards a market-based system and less of a regulatory approach that had happened in the 70s with these systems. Key features, there's really a few of them. I don't think any of these are going to be a surprise this morning. I think Bob kind of touched upon some of these, but really programs that have been identified as being a little bit more successful to the degree of being able to contain annual cost growth in hospitals had these features. One is you had a periodic updating and you were able to make adjustments for either the case mix in terms of the types of patients being seen, a variety of other, but they were able to change for each individual hospital and as well as the volume adjustment. So programs that were more successful kind of had that characteristic. Inclusion of all payers, obviously, I think that's a fundamental piece. We heard all about that, probably not a big surprise. And then having the benefit on the converse of having the Medicare waiver there. And then making the rate program simple and transparent. Bob touched upon that, really making sure that as much information that's out there being transparent to make those decisions making for those commissions. Stakeholder buy-in was critical for all the states that move forward with rate setting, and then flexibility to adapt and evolve was important as well. Let me stop there and see what questions.
Have there been any states in the last couple of years or recent time that have started evaluating and implementing a model?
No, not that I've come across. I'm looking at my colleagues in the back who've all been pouring through the literature, Jen, but no other states have moved forward with kind of revisiting and creating a new rate setting program from scratch. I think nationally there have been some articles and some health economists have recently kind of revisited the concept within kind of how healthcare is financed delivered today. So I think there's been some interest, but no other states have taken this on that I'm aware of.
Well, Vermont and Pennsylvania are kind of working on it right now, aren't they?
They are. But I would characterize it more as the global budget approach, and I guess that is the rate setting rates. You're right.
Any other questions?
So this, I won't go through this, spend a lot of time, and I want to acknowledge my colleagues in the back, Jamie Hines and Cassie Sosa. You really helped aggregate and start pulling together, I think, would be kind of our initial cut of some comparative data. And we'll continue to update this as we go on. Two caveats for those of you who carefully read. There is a, we flipped columns on one of the tables. I'm getting to it. On page 11, table 9, we put Maryland where it should have been called Oregon, so we'll make that correction. And then also on page 6, table 5, which is the insurance, enrollment by large group individual as well as the publicly funded plans. We're trying to get some data from the Maryland Insurance Administration on this because it's going to be more specific than the national data that we're able to pull from CMS. So if you would hold tight, we're going to update that. We think it's pretty close in terms of percentages, but we're waiting to finalize that data as well. So I'll just quickly walk through this, and I really would encourage each of you to kind of stop and see if there's other interesting observations for those of you who look through this, or even just this morning as we kind of walk through at a high level some of the comparison. I think just the household income, obviously, there's a substantial difference between Oregon and Maryland, and as well as the number of youth and children living in poverty. It's almost a twofold here in Oregon relative to Maryland. Obviously, I think we see some of that play out in terms of the coverage mix. Obviously, and we'll get to the slide in a minute, we have a higher number of individuals in Oregon and Medicaid and CHIP relative to Maryland. Health status, just kind of looking in general, these are some standard indicators that folks use in terms of looking at a state's overall population health. Two things that we saw, sorry, maybe the shading wasn't as good as we wanted for that, but percents of adults reporting poor or fair health status as well as poor mental health. Both in Oregon, we have a higher number of adults reporting poor or fair health status or mental health. So,
I thought the link to smoking was important there, especially when you're talking about health. That Oregon is much higher.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if Maryland has higher cigarette taxes.
There you go.
Now.
No, yeah, definitely. It's considerably higher in Oregon.
Yeah.
This is the health insurance coverage by type. We've tried to highlight. Maryland has a considerably higher number of individuals that are employer-sponsored coverage relative to what we have here in Oregon. And this is 2015 data, so this is post-ACA expansion, which they were an expansion state. And then, obviously, we have a 40% more enrollment relative to what we see in Maryland in terms of individuals that are in Medicaid.
And that's all employers, both, like, self-insured, large group, and small group.
Bundle, yeah. I don't know, and we'll look into this, I don't know what the CHIP FPL is in Maryland. I don't know if it's 300, if it's equivalent to what we have here in Oregon, but we'll check into that. That might account for a little bit of that. Total expenditures, sorry, it's a little small there. Should be larger in the handout or the electronic version. This is total in 2014, and those are in billions. I have glasses, so I can't even read that. So,
oh, yeah.
This, though, I think is probably the more interesting one. This is healthcare expenditures per capita, and this is the data source that Robert was alluding to, the national. This is national expenditure data. So this is per capita. You can see hospital care, Maryland is higher. Physician and clinical services, Maryland is higher. Other professional services were a little bit higher here in Oregon. Prescription drugs, again, I think the two where Oregon is higher is health, residential, and personal care, and I think that's because we do more of a home and community-based services relative to Maryland, which has more of an institutional, especially around their long-term. And then the other professional, which is
as well.
Dental. And dental.
Oliver, I think even though that previous slide is hard to read, the percentages at the end are really useful, showing the percentage of spending by category. I mean, we're basically follow Maryland within one percentage point either way, right?
Yeah. Thank you, Jeremy. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, for hospital care, as an example, 38 to 37. So percent of spend is about the same across expenditure categories within the health system. Yeah. So just want to kind of spotlight a little bit of kind of, because I know one of the big questions, I think, for the task force is that Medicare component, and what is the difference in terms of Medicare reimbursement per enrollee in Oregon, Maryland, and then we added the national average here, so you can see, obviously, for reasons now we understand, Maryland is higher for all of those, and then we're lower per enrollee, and this is over between 2010 to 2014. Same here. You can look at hospital reimbursement per Medicare enrollee. Maryland, again, is closer to the national average, and we're, I would say, a degree lower than Maryland in the national average in terms of reimbursement per Medicaid enrollee, Medicare enrollee. Mm-hmm. And there's even more gap between Oregon and Maryland and the national rate with physician reimbursement per Medicare. And again, these slides and the information really is just to help, I think, get a baseline of really comparing our two states and some of this.
So I'm going to show my ignorance. What causes that gap? Does anybody know?
Between Oregon and the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, what would cause that?
Doesn't that go back to the original when the DRG system came in and Oregon was considerably lower than the East Coast? So when the rates got set at that particular time, the East Coast got much higher rates than the West Coast.
Oh, okay.
For that contingent, isn't the East Coast tends to be a couple days longer on average than the West Coast?
The, the length
almost
of
3 days, isn't it?
We're like 3 days on average.
We also have a really high Medicare Advantage rate compared to the East Coast. I think mostly they're very high fee-for-service in Medicare.
Okay. I was just curious.
Great question.
Some of it's just the art of practice seems to be different on the East Coast.
And then the last one is just to show you the healthcare expenditures per capita between Maryland, Oregon, and then nationally over a pretty extensive period, so you can just see the growth where Maryland was, where the U.S. and then where Oregon is. So I think we're all pretty much on the same trajectory in overall healthcare.
That's a bad trajectory.
You know, it's interesting though that our per capita cost is lower, but we have sicker people, because the other slides showed that we had sicker people. So wouldn't our cost be higher? I'm showing my ignorance again, probably, but...
No, you're not. I don't want to speculate what the answer would be. Okay. I think we want to look into that.
That might be something we'd want to look into, because it doesn't make sense.
No, that's a really good question, though. I don't know the answer.
Okay.
Well, I have a question. Why is that trend so steep?
Why is it going up so fast?
I think, Senator Beyer, that's a good question. I know there's extensive literature that helps explain that, so we can summarize that and bring that back. Mm-hmm. What really have been the largest cost drivers in hospital care? So we'll bring that back to the task force.
I was just going to add maybe our sicker people population is linked to our poverty rate and our social determinants of health.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and also Maryland is just a significantly more affluent state across the board, which probably means that their price points for a lot of things are higher.
Mm. That makes sense, too. Okay.
So let me stop. And some of you have been able to have a little bit of time to digest kind of through that working document that we sent out last week. And I've captured a couple of additional data points. Other interesting questions that we can go away and do some research on. We have our own running internal list that we're working on, but we want to see the task force.
Thanks. So I had three things that came to mind as I was listening to the presentation earlier. One was hospital size in Oregon by revenue. So as we're thinking about the impact of global budgeting, Robert talked about revenue size as being the way we should think about size. So I know you have the distribution by number of beds, but another is some type of measurement of the consolidation of the hospital market in Oregon. So the report, that 109-page report that was sent out, talked about rate setting as one way to address with consolidation in the market. So some way of trying to quantify what has happened in Oregon in that sense would be helpful. And then the third thing was, what is our level of uncompensated care in Oregon? Robert, yeah, right. So he talked about $800 million in Maryland, and my suspicion is that we're quite a bit lower than that. But I think the reason why that's important is that it was a pretty significant factor in getting support for the program in Maryland, because there was finally a way to sort of get compensated for uncompensated care. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just wondered, when you're looking at this chart, we're going through the 90s and stuff, and so how much of that cost curve and everything's attributable to the failure of capitation, you know, in the 90s? And then we did see an explosion of services, people coming in after that period of time.
I mean, you can kind of see it goes like this.
Yeah. So yeah. To get at Representative Fahey's questions, there's a really great Excel spreadsheet that the health authority, I think it's in the Office of Policy and Analytics, I'm not sure.
If only I knew who ran that office.
Well, so it's funny because I request from that office every year. They do a great tracking of what is the margin, profit and loss of all of Oregon's hospitals. Mm-hmm. And then in the last couple of years, they've also shown how the uncompensated care and bad debt has gone down. They just track all it, and it's in an Excel spreadsheet, and it's pretty.
We have Stephen, who's behind me, actually manages that program. We can provide that really easily, and we could also bucket it out by a percentage of revenue that it is DRG versus the A's and B's, just to show you kind
so
of.
So it might be an interesting thing to look at to get at what Representative Fahey is saying, because it is. I use it in my other job quite a lot.
Could you also then look, can I couple on to just that point? Can you couple that data with then the increase in the Medicaid reimbursement, the disparity in the Medicaid reimbursement?
Maybe. I don't know. I'll phone a friend. Maybe.
So like the growth of the growth in the revenue write-off. And when you take the uncompensated bad debt is going down, but the Medicaid write-off is significantly going up at the same time.
I don't know if it shows that.
That's why I was wondering if it could, potentially.
It can.
Yes.
Yeah.
Kirsten was next.
I just wanted to add, I thought that was a great list that Representative Fahey suggested, but could we also take a regional look at it? So not only do we understand which rural hospitals are connected, or even if all hospitals in a certain area are within a system.
Evan?
That was my request, too, a regional or county perspective.
All right.
Awesome. Jen.
The insurance payer mix, because it seems like these states had a very dominant commercial payer, and it might be interesting to look statewide.
Yeah, because that does change a dynamic.
But there's a little bit of that data in what was the note. Mm-hmm. It's carriers by enrollment, I think. Right?
Yeah, we have more of that. We can certainly hold it.
Maybe more of a high-level question, but I know that there's a significant sort of debate around the extent of cost shifting and whether it even exists between public programs and commercial payers. It's the consensus in the industry that it exists, but there's quite a lot of argument among economists that it actually doesn't, and this is a myth, and I certainly don't feel qualified to adjudicate that dispute, but if we're going to recommend policy changes based on something that may or may not be real, or that we may or may not understand the extent of, I'd like to know more about the evidence. And I mean, we have, for example, John McConnell at OHSU, who I think has a lot of expertise in this.
Yep, absolutely. Okay.
So there's a lot of discussion in this around trying to create equity among payer type, but I think what we haven't talked about yet that I just would pose maybe is be worth the conversation if folks want to talk about it is also variation in individual services that are provided. So thanks to the legislature actually requiring us to put out a report now showing price variation among the top inpatient and outpatient services, we can also see some huge variation. So I don't know if that's potentially something that we want to talk about at some point, but we've also got reports on that Stephen's been producing over the last couple of years.
Nods around the table, so it sounds like that would be helpful to bring. Okay. Okay. And between now and your drive home or your holiday break, there are other data points or questions, send them to my inbox, and we'll just keep the running tally and make sure that we're bringing that too. So please, once you leave here, you probably will want to stop thinking about this for a little while, but when you come back to it, just feel free to email me. So I want to shift gears to the task force principles.
Right. Yep, that works.
Okay.
So did everybody have a chance to read it, Oliver, and worked on incorporating our comments from last time? And just want to know if we're good with it or if we still want to tinker?
So just to make everyone, just a quick kind of refresher.
Yeah.
Some of the conversation at our last meeting centered, well, this is talking about hospital rate setting. That really should be at the top. And so we added promotes hospital financing that is sufficient, fair, sustainable, and then supports value, paying for outcomes value among Oregon hospitals, made it a little bit more specific. Again, this is just based on the conversation you all had last month. Back to that avoids cost shifting for all payers. I think that came up on the equity piece of this. And then Center Hayward had the suggestion, and we had some conversation about the quadruple aim. And so just saying also the improves work life of healthcare professionals. So those are the changes that are reflected. Obviously up there you can see in the red font.
Is everybody good with those?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I see equitable access, does it mean the same thing as health equity? So we have equitable in there, but I would like to shift that and say promotes access with a health equity lens versus equitable access. Because I think the two are very different.
How
do you think they're different?
Health equity. You're looking at those people that do not have access to care based on inequities. It may be based on gender. It may be based on race. It may be based on their identification. And it's allowing everybody to have the same equal access to health. It's different than saying everybody has access to health is different than elevating up those that have low inequity to the same level of standard of those that have high equity of health.
I mean, if we're going to go there, I would say it's not just about access either. It's about improving equity of outcomes.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know how explicit we need to be about this in the principles statement, but I think it is certainly an important principle.
I would say my other comment on avoids cost shifting for all payers is, you know, I wonder based on what we heard today if that's possible. So I don't know if there's if we should soften that or, I mean, sort of to comments earlier.
It's kind of a counterbalance to former discussion.
We're aiming towards that.
We're aiming towards that. So that is a principle that we're kind of trying to hold to. I think I think we might want to leave that, in my opinion.
The one thing, the first one kind of gets at it, but I think one of the overarching is to trying to bend that cost curve down. And that really isn't replicated there, but that's really where I started from.
I do think the one thing that isn't represented here, and maybe it's because it's too broad, is that to really bend the cost curve, you need to be looking at the total cost of care. And that's the piece where this is it feels like it's a narrower slice of that. So I don't know how that will weave into the work of the task force. I mean, I guess you could say it's in lower cost if you think of lower cost as total lower cost, but
it feels buried given that that is what all brings us all to this room,
mm-hmm.
right?
What are everybody else's thoughts?
There's other work groups that are looking at other costs in the healthcare system. I mean,
focus on hospitals, but other entities around here are focused on drugs or, you know, out of pocket. You know, the, what do we do about
just balance billing?
Thank you.
Yeah.
There's even a committee trying to figure out, like, you know, if we were going to have a comprehensive healthcare system. I don't want to use single payer because I don't think that's its mandate to figure that out. But, like, you know, there's a committee looking at those things too.
It's a good list.
Do you want Oliver to take a second pass at making those changes that you guys just talked about?
Sure, take another cut and
try. Yeah. We'll debate it
every meeting. By the end of this, we will have our principles.
By September of
2018. But at least we talk about them at every meeting.
That's good. Okay.
Okay. Are we good? And then we need to talk about our charter.
No, that well, the, was the principles. Yeah, were in the charter, so that was it.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I do what Oliver tells me. Okay, next steps.
So I want to apologize for having to reschedule the January 9th meeting. There is traditionally or historically a day called Task Force Day during Ledge Days. That Task Force Day has now been repurposed for a different meeting. So it required us staff to go and find a new date. So we pulled the legislators on the group. Thank you to each of you and your staff for being responsive. And the 19th was the date that worked best for everyone. And I've heard, I think, for almost all you are able to make it except for one. So that should still be a pretty good turnout. So thank you for doing that. Just to give you a little highlight of coming attractions, I'll work with Jeremy and his staff thinking about what kind of the OHA pieces in terms of data, in terms of a presentation. But we do have Jerry Anderson from the Bloomberg School of Public Health. He has done extensive research on rate setting. And so I think he'll offer a little bit deeper dive on some of the effects that Maryland has seen from a research perspective. So we're happy to have him. And then you already heard Bob talk about Jack Keane. He's an active commissioner with the Maryland Health Services, and he's agreed to join us by phone. So I think that'll be great to hear him. And then he's also thought about what has been the impact of some of the payers in Maryland. So he can speak extensively from that. And then we're also working on inviting we have invited, but trying to nail down availability for someone that staff that actually is on the Health Services Review Commission as well the Insurance Administration. So stay tuned. We'll finalize up the list of presenters. No meeting in February. Just to remind everyone, we're in the midst of session. The short sessions are always unhectic and slow. So we realize that in advance. And then we're working to finalize the meetings in March through June for this task force. Hopefully those will get pinned down, and then this is just kind of the map, roadmap forward of what else to expect. Sorry, it's a little small, I see. But you can look at it online. It's available, and it reflects kind of the conversation. Last month, we'll update it to reflect kind of what's going to be happening January and March as well.
Do we have any public comment?
I'm looking over to
public
Ashley.
Comment. Anyone sign up for public comment? Nope. Okay. Anything else before we go? All right. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you.
Happy holidays.
Next, everybody. We'll see you.
Happy holidays.
Next. Thank you, everybody.